is something going on in the ether.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for the week starting October 6th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot Organizer. Radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website. And some audio was borrowed from the Radio Roots crew at WBAI in New York. This Week in Radical History for October 7th.
I dreamed I saw Joe Hill last night, alive as you and me. Says I, but Joe, you're 10 years dead. I never died, says he. I never died, says he.
In 1879, labor organizer Joe Hill is born. He'd be killed on this date by the state of Utah after a sham trial. He wired his labor organizers' friends these words: I'd like to die a true blue rebel. Don't waste any more time mourning. Organize. And his last words in front of the firing squad was, fire.
San Diego up to Maine, in every mine and mill, where working men defend their rights, it's there you'll find Joe Hill.
And it is right here where you will find more radical history. Like on October 7th in 1909, letting all principals know what's up, the U.S. consulate reports a revolution against the Nicaraguan government will begin on October 8th. Also on this date in 1934 in Brazil, green shirt fascists in Sao Paulo attempt to mimic Mussolini's march on Rome, only to be scattered in disarray when confronted by the anarchists and farm workers, who unite in opposition to the fascists. Also on this date in 1969, the Haymarket statue, a memorial to cops slain who fired on workers in 1886 in Chicago, is bombed, reported to be bombed by the Weather Underground. The mayor rebuilds the statue, and it is bombed again next year. Learning his lesson, the mayor rebuilds it again and has to place a 24-hour guard around the statue. Also on this date in 1969, black football players at the University of Wyoming are kicked off the team for protesting against the Mormons of Utah State for segregation at Brigham Young University. Also on October 7, 1987, religious zealous and hypocrite Pat Robinson acknowledges to the Wall Street Journal report that he's been less than candid about his wedding date and his first child was born only 10 weeks after his marriage. He follows a long line before him and after him, like family values man Ronald Reagan, who married his second wife, Nancy, who had a baby 7 months after that, and hypocrite VP candidate Palin shotgun weddings. In your face, Christian family values. Two more items for October 7, 1990. Justice Department reports U.S. prison population doubled in the last 10 years, worst in the Western world. Yeah, we're number one. We're number one. Lastly, in 1993, Guatemala, a mass grave of 150 women and children murdered by the U.S.-supported and trained Guatemala army is opened. The U.S. government documents released in 1999 describes in chilling detail, often in cold bureaucratic language, how American advisors and their Cold War obsession spurred on the killing and hid the horrible secrets from the public. This Week in Radical History for October 8th, only got a couple items. 1871, Mrs. O'Leary's cow starts a Chicago fire in the evening, kills over 200 and over 98,000 left homeless as 3.5 square miles of the city burn to the ground. As Chicago blazes away some 200 miles to the south, an even deadlier fire rips through Peshtigo, Wisconsin, completely razing to the town and killing 600 of its inhabitants. Over 1 million acres of forest was also consumed. Also for October 8, 1976, President Ford signs a bill to terminate Indian Claims Commission, ending any mechanism for repayment of land stolen from the tribes. In the year 2000, over 1,000 protesters gather to oppose Hong Kong's law prohibiting public demonstration by more than 30 people without permission of Officer Friendly. You know, why not do what freedom-loving, protecting United States does and give protesters free speech zones, nice pinned-in areas to express themselves? Also in the year 2000, that date, hey Saddam, beat this. American government releases documents showing it tested chemical and biological weapons in the open air in Alaska, Hawaii, Alberta, Canada, and Great Britain. We're number one. We're number one. This Week in Radical History for October 9th, breaking the myth once again that America was founded on religious freedoms. In 1635, Roger Williams, a member of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, an outspoken critic of the ill treatment of Native Americans, is banished from the colonies for, quote, religious heresy, unquote.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 9th in 1823, black American abolitionist and newspaper publisher Mary Ann Shad Carey was born in Wilmington, Delaware. When Mary was 17 years old, she opened a school for black children in Pennsylvania. 10 years later, the Fugitive Slave Act was passed and Mary moved to Canada, where she founded a racially integrated school, as well as establishing the Provincial Freeman, a newspaper that attacked slavery and promoted the education of blacks. After moving back to the U.S., Mary graduated from Howard Law School, becoming the second black woman in the U.S. to graduate with a law degree. During her career as a lawyer, Mary Ann Shad worked hard to achieve voting rights for women in America. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on this date in 1936, during a lettuce strike in Salinas, California, red flags appeared around town, specifically at intersections and power poles. Fearing communists, the local authorities took down the flags, only to discover later that they were part of a traffic check being made by the State Highway Division. Oops. Also on this date in 1969, 2,500 National Guard called into Chicago, Illinois, for the 9th through the 11th during the Weather Underground Days of Rage protest. For a great movie on the Weather Underground, to see a pretty reasonable evolution and delusion of political uprising in this country, see the Academy Award-nominated movie from 2 years ago, also called Weather Underground. Also on October 9, 1970 in England, the Italian Trade Center, Exhibition Building, Cork Street, London is bombed. Attacks simultaneously happen in Manchester, Birmingham, Paris, and against Italian state buildings. The attacks were claimed on behalf of an Italian anarchist murdered by the police in 1969, part of a large series of bombings for this year, believed to be attributed to the Anarchist Angry Brigade. Two more items were October 9, 1983. James Watts resigns as Reagan's Secretary of the Interior, after referring to his appointment of a black, a woman, two Jews, and a cripple. Early in this week, one of Reagan's aides also pleads guilty to the involvement in the weapons for hostage trade Iran-Contra scandal.
We talk without words, and everybody understands. Just desserts, delivered by hand. Nobody move, or the CEO hits it in the face with cream and dough.
See the scramble to the top.
Lastly, for October 9, 1998, neoliberal economist Milton Friedman gets just desserts at the Marriott Hotel in San Francisco during the School Choice and Corporate America Conference. The Triple B field agents, custard and lemon meringue, approached him and let fly with tofu cream and sweet potato pies. Just desserts, delivered by hand. This week in Radical History for October 10th, 1609 in England. Jared Winstanley, founder of the Diggers, is born. The Diggers attempted to reform by leveling real property, the existing social order of the time, with an agrarian lifestyle based upon their ideas of the creation of a small, egalitarian rural communities. Their use of public lands in England enraged the local manor owners and townspeople, and the government would eventually put them all down. Here's a song about the Diggers, written by Winstanley at the time, sung by the anarchist group Chumbawamba.
Stand up now, you noble diggers, all stand up now. The wasteland to maintain, seen cavaliers by name, your digging does maintain, and persons all defame. Stand up now. With spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now, with spades and hoes and ploughs, stand up now. Your freedom to uphold, seen cavaliers are bold, to kill you if they could, and rights from you to hold, stand up now, diggers all. The lawyers they conjoin, stand up now, the lawyers they conjoin, stand up now. To arrest you they advise, such fury they devise, the devil in them lies, and have blinded both their eyes, stand up now,
clergy, they come in. Stand up now, the clergy, they come in. Stand up now. The clergy, they come in and say it is a sin that we should now begin our freedom for to win. Stand up now, diggers all. The gentry are all round. Stand up now, the gentry are all round. Stand up now. The gentry are all round, on each side they are found, their wisdom so profound, to cheat us of our ground. Stand up now, the club is all their law. Stand up now, the club is all their law. Stand up now. The club is all their law, to keep poor men in awe, that they no vision saw, to maintain such a law. Stand up now, diggers all.
Couple more items for October 10th, 1954 in Guatemala. CIA-sponsored Colonel Carlos Armas becomes president, via democracy, America style. Also 1960, Irish poet and playwright Brendan Behan appears on Jack Parr's show and famously says, "I've never seen a situation so dismal that the police can't make it worse." Also, the diggers are back in the news, only this time 350 years later in 1966, when the modern-day version of the diggers, founded in San Francisco, start distributing free food at the Golden Gate Park. Lastly, in 1990, reparation payments begin to survivors and families of the Japanese Americans taken from their homes and put into concentration camps during World War II. In the entire course of the war, 10 people would be convicted of spying for Japan, all of whom are Caucasians. That's score again, folks. Caucasians 10, Asians 0. This week in Radical History for October 11th, 1910, Nicaragua, three generals and U.S. company officials form a governing junta to protect the American interests. Also on that date in 1958, the second attempt to send a rocket around the moon fails when its excessively high trajectory causes it to fall back to Earth. The U.S. space program, however, will improve under von Buren and his 126 Nazis whisked away for us. Most of the Rocketeers were dedicated German Nazis whisked out of Europe to continue the work for us here in the United States. At the time of their surrender, they were working on a rocket to deliver warheads to New York City, as they had done to London with the V-2. Under Operation Paperclip, these war criminals were slipped away to the United States, kept under wraps, and referred to themselves as POPs, Prisoners of Peace, at Fort Bliss, Texas.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 11th in 1972, a group of Chicano teachers, students, and community activists in Seattle, Washington, entered the abandoned Beacon Hill High School building and announced their intention to stay until the city met their demands. The group peacefully occupied the school for 3 months in the middle of winter before they were finally granted the space to establish a Chicano community center. This action was triggered after the city abruptly cut funding for an adult basic education and ESL program at the local community college, leaving its students ripped of their educational resources. The community center, El Centro de la Raza, became one of the most effective Latino civil rights organizations in America. Now that's community empowerment. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Lastly, for October 11th, 1987, up to 750,000 gays, lesbians, and bisexuals and their supporters marched for civil rights in Washington. This is the second lesbian and gay march, and again generally goes underreported by the press. Now each year at this time it is celebrated as the National Coming Out Day. This week in Radical History for October 12th, 1492 in the New World, Columbus. Invader, slaver, thief, murderer, liar, madman, he and his crew signals the start of the European invasion of the Americas. "We could subjugate them all," unquote. Columbus wrote at the start of the European destruction of the American continent, "There is no holiday for the tribes of the Arawaks, who lived there at the time that Columbus discovered them. In the next 25 years, all 50,000 natives had died or been shipped away as slaves." Also on October 10, 1896, Johann Most, German-American anarchist, and Emma Goldman's former mentor, denounces her at the time of the event of the New York, where she was soliciting funds for the commemoration of the execution of the Haymarket martyrs. Emma would seek him out, find him on stage, and punch him in the face.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, October 12th in 1898, the Verdun Massacre occurred when a labor conflict between the Chicago Verdun Coal Company and their unionized miners in St. Louis turned violent. The tension began after the Verdun Company backed down on their promise to enforce an 8-hour workday and a pay increase. The company then brought in hundreds of non-unionized black laborers from Alabama and locked the union workers out of the mines. As a train carrying the strike breakers arrived, shots were fired between the strikers and the armed guards, resulting in the death of many union members and a few guards. The Verdun Company then left the black laborers stranded in St. Louis with no money or shelter and gave in to the mining union's terms. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Also on this date, 1925 in Panama, 600 U.S. Marines land and take over police duties in Panama City during the strike and rent riots to, okay, all together now, say it with me, to protect the American interests. Also in 1950, the American Legion Conventions calls for the concentration camps for all U.S. communists and the atom bombing of the Soviet Union. Yeah, right, you guys first, okay? Also in 1970, Lieutenant William Calley court-martialed for the massacre of 102 civilians at My Lai during the Vietnam War. He will get his wrist slaps with 1 year of house arrest and is considered by many in the right wing to be a war hero. By the way, the original investigating officer who started the My Lai massacre cover-up, that would be then First Lieutenant Colin Powell. Also on that date in 1971 in Cuba, the CIA sponsored terrorist attacks at Boca de Sama, machine gunning the village, killing two and injuring four, one of the four, a 15-year-old girl who lost her legs as a result of gunshot wounds. God bless America. The White House Press Secretary Ronald Reagan's mouthpiece, Larry Speaks, tells the press pool in this state in 1982, quote, "You don't tell us how to stage the news, and we won't tell you how to report it," unquote. Humiliated by Bush aides describing their job as having to potty train him, VP Dan Quayle declares independence from his handlers. Quote, "Look it," he says, "I've done it their way this far, and now it's my turn. I'm my own handler. Any questions? Ask me. There's not going to be any more handler stories because I'm the handler. I'm the Dr. Spin," unquote. Deja vu all over again.
But her job is also to deal interagency and to help unstick things that may get stuck. Best way to put it. And unstick it. And, listening? Okay, well, she's doing a fine job.
That's why I say I, like every American I'm speaking with, we're ill about this position that we have been put in, where it is the taxpayers looking to bail out. But ultimately, what the bailout does is help those who are concerned about the health care reform that is needed to help shore up our economy, it's got to be all about jobs.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on. If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
Creation to shoring up our economy and putting it back on the right track. So health care reform and reducing taxes and reining in spending has got to accompany tax reductions and tax relief for Americans. And trade, we've got to see trade as opportunity, not as a competitive, scary thing, but 1 in 5 jobs being created in the trade sector today. We've got to look at that as more opportunity. All those things under the umbrella of job creation, this bailout is a part of that.
Well, it's going to find you and to help unstick things that may get stuck. That's what it's called. It's an unsticker. It's an unsticker.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is John Roberts. We have been celebrating the way in which oppressed peoples are seeing the commonality of the struggles of others around the globe and are rising up in support of each other. Whether it is around the issue of incarceration, police abuse, blatant discrimination, or land confiscation, hands are being extended around the world to challenge all forms of oppression. A marvelous example of this, the Palestinian Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions National Committee, called the BNC, has written the following statement of support to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe, which is fighting the Dakota Access Pipeline being constructed by the Energy Transfer Partners Corporation. The largest coalition in Palestinian civil society that leads the global BDS movement sends a message of solidarity to the sovereign Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. The people of Palestine support you and all those standing with you right now in North Dakota to protect your tribal lands and resist the desecration and destruction of your sacred burial sites at the hands of the Energy Transfer Partners Corporation and the Dakota Access Pipeline they are building. The BNC supports the restoration of all lands guaranteed by treaty to the Standing Rock Sioux and all other indigenous nations. As indigenous Palestinians, we pledge to stand in solidarity with indigenous peoples around the world, including in Turtle Island, in their struggles for justice, determination, restoration of rights, and respect for their heritage. Palestinians understand all too well how settler colonial authorities use resource extraction and other economic and bureaucratic pretenses as a way to solidify control over indigenous land and dispossess indigenous people. When we look at Standing Rock, we see our indigenous sisters and brothers defending their land, their identity, their dignity, and their heritage. Your response to the pipeline project defends not only the rights of all those who utilize the watershed of the Missouri River from potential environmental catastrophe, it ultimately defends all of us from continued fossil fuel extraction at a time when climate change threatens us all. When we look at Standing Rock, we also see the attempts of authorities with a still prevalent colonial mentality to vilify, criminalize, and ultimately disappear indigenous peoples on their own land. The Palestinian people have firsthand experience with the colonial power desecrating our burial sites, destroying our indigenous communities, and appropriating our culture and otherwise gradually erasing our centuries-old heritage. Israel's regime of occupation, settler colonialism, and apartheid, with the help of the U.S.-based Simon Wiesenthal Center, has ruthlessly destroyed and desecrated large portions of the ancient Palestinian Mamilla Cemetery in Jerusalem to build the so-called Museum of Tolerance, without any sense of irony. Mamilla is a Muslim burial ground and holy site believed to date back to the 7th century. Numerous Sufi saints and thousands of other Arab officials, scholars, notables, and Jerusalem Palestinian families, including companions of the Prophet Muhammad, have been buried in the cemetery over the last 1,000 years. Since 2010, the Center for Constitutional Rights in the United States and the Campaign to Preserve Mamilla Cemetery, led by Palestinian figures with direct connections to some of those buried in Mamilla, have worked to halt construction of the new facility and preserve what remains of the site. The BDS movement has learned much from and has been profoundly inspired by the history of resistance to other settler colonial projects, such as the more than 500 years of indigenous resistance to the genocidal European colonialism in the Western Hemisphere, including the United States. Your tribe and your many allies are part of a grand tradition of resilience and resistance in the face of dispossession of ancestral lands, cultural destruction, forced relocation and ethnic cleansing, brutal wars, and genocide. We owe the indigenous people of Turtle Island a great debt for lighting the way and showing what it means to resiliently resist colonialism generation after generation for more than half a millennium. The BNC was dismayed but not surprised to learn that the multinational security corporation G4S has been contracted to provide security services for the pipeline construction on your land by Energy Transfer Partners. G4S is involved in human rights abuses around the world, including in Palestine, where the company provides services to illegal Israeli colonies, to military checkpoints, and to prisons that are infamous for using torture and inhumane treatment against Palestinian prisoners, including children. We are particularly horrified to learn that on September 4th, defenders of your ancestral land were attacked with dogs and pepper spray, a chemical weapon used by a different private security company hired to protect pipeline construction. The BNC calls for intensifying worldwide boycott and divestment campaigns against G4S and all private security companies that violate our human rights and use weapons and violence against the indigenous people whose land they are operating on and against oppressed communities the world over. Once again, violence and brutality are being used to attempt to control the people standing up for their land, their culture, and the earth. Once again, the resistance will not be contained or curtailed by the violence and intimidation tactics of the oppressors. The BNC is committed to building stronger ties of solidarity between our peoples and movements, and we will work with our partners in North America to make this a reality. From Palestine to Standing Rock, we shall stand united against colonialism, corporate criminality, and for all our inalienable rights to freedom, justice, and equality. That was a statement of solidarity sent from the Palestinian BDS National Committee to the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in North America. And now on to our feature presentation this morning. It is a presentation given by Miko Peled. Miko was born in Jerusalem in 1961 into a well-known Zionist family. His grandfather was a Zionist leader and signer on the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His father, Mati Peled, was a young officer in the War of 1948 and a general in the War of 1967 when Israel conquered the West Bank, Gaza, the Golan Heights, and the Sinai. But Miko has a different vision for Israel and for the Palestinian people, as you will hear. And now here is Miko Peled speaking at the Church Center for the United Nations in New York City.
I just got back about 2 weeks ago from Palestine. Listen, I have to say this particular visit was probably more difficult than most, because the reality, the pressure under which Palestinians live and the blatant disregard on the part of Israel for Palestinian life and the reality in which Palestinians live is almost hard to describe in words. And now we have this book, and I see it as a great opportunity to do two things. First of all, tell the story, which people listen to, and that's a good thing. Many people say, well, if a Palestinian said this, nobody would be listening. So I'm glad to have that platform. And the other thing, which I think is really missing from the conversation here in this country, although it's improving, is context. We very rarely hear about this issue with context. So suddenly Palestinians are stabbing people. Suddenly there's, rockets flying out of Gaza. Suddenly this happens. But there's never any context. And what the book allows me to do and what I do in these in talks is to put together the context and kind of a timeline, how it began, where we stand today, and how do we move forward. And I'd like to start with a couple of questions. So first question is, are Palestine and Israel one country or two? Is the reality on the ground there one that is of war, or is it a struggle for freedom and justice? Is the way to achieve our goal, is it something we do through peace talks, or is what required resistance? I think these are really, really important questions to ask, especially like Helena was mentioning, we're right across the street from the United Nations, and now we've got the Palestinian flag that was raised there a few months ago. Because I think this is a big part of the context. This is a big part of moving forward and understanding where we stand. We hear people say, I visited Israel and I visited Palestine. And we hear people, or we hear countries that have been recognizing the state of Palestine. And so I always ask, well, where is this state of Palestine? I mean, the country is obviously the same country. It has two names. We have Israelis and Palestinians who live there, so two nations. But where is this state that people talk about? What are its boundaries? Who are its citizens? These are questions that are really important. And then, again, is what we're trying to achieve achievable through peace talks, or is it going to require resistance? And then what does the resistance look like? And unless we touch on each and every one of these issues, I think we're never going to be able to move forward. Now, a requisite for, or prerequisite for understanding this is also, like I said, the context. And again, if we don't put it in some kind of historical context, then we're never going to be able to solve the problem. And I would say that it's fair to claim that the reason there's a problem in Palestine is because of racism and colonialism that came to Palestine from Europe. And when we look at the history of how things developed, then we have what everybody knows, I think most people are familiar with, is this thing called the Balfour Declaration, which in Israel is considered almost like one of the Ten Commandments. You think it came down the mountain with Moses. It was, every street, every city in Israel has a Balfour Street. So you think, well, who is this Balfour? Who is this saint or prophet? And what did he say? And what is this Balfour Declaration? And when we look right at it, it's basically Lord Balfour, who's the Foreign Secretary of Britain, promising a Jewish millionaire by the name of Rothschild Palestine for the Jewish people. And there were very few Jewish people in Palestine, and neither Rothschild nor Balfour had lived or had anything to do with Palestine. But this was the reality where white people could just take brown people's land and do what they wanted with it. And this is another example of that. And then the United Nations intervenes, and we have the partition plan. And unless we understand this partition plan, again, there's no way to understand how we got to where we are today and what came after that. And these are things that when we have the normal dialogue groups and the normal kind of conversations between Israelis and Palestinians, Israelis usually do not want to discuss. They do not want to discuss that part of the history. They always say we need to look forward, we need to move on beyond that. And I think we have to discuss it, so I'm going to discuss it. And if we look at the partition plan, this is a map of the partition plan, which the United Nations passed. I have to assume that whoever drew this map must have been on drugs or hungover or something, because it's an absurd map. The boundaries are obviously, you know, completely unachievable. But besides that, as we can see, they divided the country into a large part and a small part, a bigger country and a smaller country. And there's this impression here in America, and I think generally around the world, the Jews have always lived there. You know, that has always been populated by Jews. That they, today, citizens of Israel, we are the descendants of the ancient Israelites, and we've always been there. And what people don't realize, when this plan was put together, there were less, or maybe just about 500,000 or half a million Jews living in Palestine. Most of them were, like my grandparents, Jews who came to colonize, who had arrived, you know, in the 40 or 50 years prior to that. And then the first generation Israelis, which were my parents' generation. That was it. Now, the vast majority of the population, at least three times as many, were the local Palestinians. And they were given the smaller portion. So the United Nations gave the larger portion of the land to a small community of immigrants or colonizers who just got off the boat, basically. And then, of course, the expectation that this was going to work is absurd. But what's even more important about this, or equally important, is how we interpret what happened next. And this is the pillar of the conflict. These are the main pillars upon which this conflict rests. It's how we interpret what happened from that moment on. So the story that I was raised upon, and the story that we learn in America and basically the West has accepted, is the Zionist version, which says that this was a story of revival and heroism. After the United Nations passed the partition resolution, the Arabs attacked the Jewish community, wanting to kill them. And miraculously, because we're heroes, because we are the descendants of King David who defeated Goliath and so forth, we were able to defeat the Arabs once again, or, you know, some evil empire once again, and we prevailed, and now we have a state for the Jewish people in their historic homeland after 2,000 years. Again, it's like a chapter out of the Bible, like a chapter out of the Old Testament. It's so dramatic, and how do you even begin to argue with that? And then we have the Palestinian version, which talks about ethnic cleansing, terrorism, and a very cruel occupation. Now, go bridge those two stories. They're unbridgeable. And I think one of the realities we have to accept about this issue is that when you accept one narrative, you necessarily reject the other. They can't live together. And it's one of these issues, and I think the solution and the reality today is the same. You either, by accepting one narrative, you reject the other. There's no room here for them to live together. They are diametrically opposed. And this is something which is very difficult for some people to accept. They say about me in my talk that I'm divisive, and I'm saying it's not me that's divisive. The reality is such that if you take a stance, it's divisive, you know. But this is why it's divisive. We have two stories that emerged after this point at the end of 1947, 1948, that are diametrically opposed. And it really wasn't until Israeli historians began looking into this, like Ilan Pape and some of the others, and validating what the Palestinians have been saying, that people began to pay attention to the Palestinian narrative. Palestinians have been saying these things for decades, but we can't believe them. Ilan Pappa says it, you know, Jewish Israeli with German background, and now people are paying attention. So that's the sad reality of this. Now, I had another interesting experience, which was very personal, and I relate the story in my book, and that's a story that has to do with my mother. And my mother was born and raised in Jerusalem. She still lives there. She's going to be 90 this year. And a story that she told me many, many times as I was growing up has to do with an experience that she had in 1948. Now, living in Jerusalem as she did, and she still does, she was living in a small apartment with her parents. And when the Israeli forces came in and took the Palestinian neighborhoods of Jerusalem, I'm talking about West Jerusalem, which became part of Israel, these beautiful Palestinian homes became available and were offered to Israeli families. So my mother was offered one of these homes. And by the way, these neighborhoods and these homes are still there. They're occupied by Israelis. But my mother decided, she refused. She said, I'm not going to take the home of another family. How can I possibly move into the home of another mother? Now, at 22 and being already a mother, refusing a beautiful home for practically for free is not something that's easy to do. So we're all very proud and happy that she did that. And then when she told me the story, and again, she told me the story many, many times as I was growing up, she would continue the story by saying that after the Palestinians were forced out of their homes and these homes were taken, there was looting that was done by the Israeli soldiers. And she remembers seeing the trucks full of loot, full of furniture and rugs, and these well-to-do communities, well-to-do homes. And again, we're talking about the part of Jerusalem which became Israel, West Jerusalem. So it's a very interesting story, and it's a very good story. But for me, growing up, this story was a big problem. Because on the one hand, we have the narrative. And on the other hand, there's a very personal story of my mother. And the two contradict each other, you know. And I wasn't really able to understand why this story was a problem for me until I was working on the book and I realized that there's a problem here because her personal story contradicts the national narrative. Now we go on and we hear that there actually wasn't really a Palestine. And if there was a Palestine and if there were Palestinians, then there weren't that many of them, and the ones that were there were poor farmers or Bedouins, and you know there was nothing there. So I like to show these pictures from the city of Yaffa, which is a city, you know, an Arab city on the coast of the Mediterranean. And it was a city of about 120,000 people with a rich business life and a social life and a cultural life, and a very famous theater called the Jamal al-Basha Theater was there, and the biggest names in the Arab world would come to perform. And several newspapers were published in Yaffa. And it was a thriving Arab city. And you can see the beautiful boulevards. And then in a matter of 2 weeks, in 1948, this big, beautiful city was brought down to about 4,000 people. And these 4,000 people were concentrated in one neighborhood with barbed wires and Israeli guards surrounding them. Now, this is an important story for several reasons. First of all, there was a Palestine, and this is one example of one city. Besides that, it shows us that Palestine is not and cannot be limited to just the West Bank and Gaza. And number three, this explains the refugee problem. Because people talk about the Palestinian refugee problem, as though it just came out of thin air. It's just there, the refugee problem. How did that happen? And where did these refugees come from? So I think this is an important story to tell. And again, Yaffa is just one example. Now, between 1948 and 1949, 1967, this is what the map looked like. Now, depending on where you stand on this issue, if you're a Palestinian and you understand and you're familiar with the Palestinian narrative, this is occupied Palestine. If you're an Israeli, or if you view it in an Israeli from the Israeli perspective, then this is the state of Israel prior to 1967, and perhaps one day, through some kind of mythical peace agreement with a two-state solution, this is what it's going to look like. And people still have this map from time to time, although in Israel this map doesn't exist. You're not going to see this in Israel anywhere. Not in school books, not in weather maps, not in any official documents. This does not. You don't see this delineation. But I think unless we come to terms with the fact that the occupation did not begin in 1967, the occupation of Palestine began in 1948, and that this represents occupied Palestine, the first 20 years of the occupied Palestine, where the majority of the land was taken by Israel, and settlers and settlements were built there, and settlers lived there. And although Israelis who live in Tel Aviv and some of these other places don't like to call themselves settlers, that's exactly what we are. And the land was stolen and the water was stolen and so forth. Unless we understand this, it's very hard to move forward. And this is a point where I still see people, even Palestinians will say, yeah, you know, the occupied Palestinian territories, and they refer to the West Bank and Gaza. And my question is, well, where are the Palestinian territories that are not occupied? Can somebody show them to me? And of course, there is no such thing, all of Palestine. And then what happened in 1967, again, the story that we hear is that Israel was under an existential threat, had no choice but to start the war, and then took the land, and it was spoils of war, and then maybe one day we'll have peace based on this map. Now, this is a picture of my father, you know, the general's son. This is the general while he was still in office, while he's still in uniform. And he made a name for himself as being, you know, a fierce young officer in 1948 who, you know, fought and, you know, on the Israeli side, of course, and fought for the land and fought for the people, the Jewish people, and so on. And then in 1967, as part of the Israeli High Command, who took the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, and all the other territories that were taken in 1967. But he did something very interesting, because immediately after the war, he stood up, all state in uniform, and said, we now have an opportunity to solve the Palestinian problem, and what we need to do is to allow the Palestinians to establish a state in those two areas, the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Which, by the way, those two areas, how did they become? Who created the West Bank and the Gaza Strip? Israel did. The reason that there is a West Bank and a Gaza Strip is because in 1948, Israel decided to keep those two areas out of the state of Israel. So they were delineated and defined by Israel. So that's what my father said immediately after the war. Of course, as he was saying this, this was the fifth or sixth day of the war. It was a six-day war. Israeli bulldozers were already destroying Palestinian towns and building Israeli settlements for Jews only in the West Bank, like they do everywhere else. And then he continued after he retired from the military to pursue this, and that was his legacy. The second half of his life he dedicated to this idea of the two-state solution and Israeli-Palestinian peace. It's based on that, and that's really when the idea of the two-state solution was invented. That's, you know, him and several others, they were the first ones to talk about it. And at some point in the mid-70s, they were contacted, he and these other Israelis were contacted by members of the PLO who were interested in this. And in this picture, he's with Issam Sartawi, who was a Palestinian ambassador in Paris for many years. And the issue was to convince, particularly Yasser Arafat, but to convince basically the Palestinian leadership or the rest of the Palestinian leadership that they should recognize the state of Israel, drop the demand for the return of the refugees, drop the armed struggle, drop the resistance completely, and make peace with the state of Israel. And this was something that took many years. And Issam Sartawi was one of the Palestinians who led this within the PLO. What we know today, looking back, is eventually they did convince Yasser Arafat. Eventually he did accept the state of Israel and drop the resistance and the demand to free all of Palestine. And that led to the Oslo peace process. And again, looking back as we what we know today, it was a catastrophic decision. The recognition of the state of Israel, the willingness to engage in peace talks with Israel, and the whole idea of the two-state solution and moving forward with that idea was catastrophic for the Palestinians. It was a big mistake. And much of the reason that the reality in Palestine for Palestinians is so severe today has to do with giving up the struggle to really free Palestine and the recognition of the state of Israel. But there's this tendency that any willingness on the part of any Israeli or any Jew to make the smallest concession or recognize in the smallest way the Palestinian suffering already hails, people start hailing them as peace heroes, as men of peace or women of peace. And, you know, this becomes the story. This particular general or that particular general spoke about peace. But they never renounce what they've done. And this is true for my father. I think my father was very sincere in his desire to bring about peace, and he really thought, and some of the people around him really thought, that the two-state solution was the only solution that was that had some chance. But the reality is they never looked back and said this entire thing was a crime. The entire ethnic cleansing of Palestine was a crime. And we need to somehow atone for that. That really never is something that never took place. So in summing up, and I think this is very important, what happened in 1967? In 1967, the occupation of Palestine did not begin. In 1967, Israel completed the occupation of Palestine, and the generals that were my father's comrades in arms all congratulated themselves for completing the job. They called it finishing the job. The occupation that began in 1948 was completed in 1967. It was not the beginning of something, it was the completion of the process. Which is why they went right ahead and started building cities and towns for Jews only like they did in other parts of the country. They didn't see that there was any difference between the West Bank, what they call Judea and Samaria. Nobody says West Bank in Israel. It's Judea and Samaria or the Galilee or any other place. The second thing that happened, or as a result of that, is the finalizing of the single state over all of Palestine with exclusive rights for Jewish people, what they call the Jewish state. And I think this is another crucial element. There is no possibility of a two-state. There is no possibility of a partition. There is a single state over all of Palestine. Israel established a single state. It's a single state for Jewish people, or with exclusive rights for Jewish people. Now, the reason I take issue with the fact that they call it a Jewish state is because I don't know what's Jewish about it. The majority of the people who live there are not Jews. There's the Palestinian majority. Most Jewish people don't live there. Most Jewish people live in other places. And I've never even been there. There's nothing inherently Jewish about the state of Israel, other than they use it, you know, the Star of David. But the regime that was established, as soon as the state of Israel was created, it was a regime of apartheid. Of course, they don't call it apartheid. They call it something else. But it was a regime of apartheid. The very first laws that were passed by the Knesset were laws that clearly defined Israel as a racist apartheid state. I mean, the mere definition of it as a Jewish state, where everybody knows that this was taken from Arabs, and there was a big Arab-Palestinian population still there, is already racist. But we go on to the laws that relate to the land ownership and laws that relate to citizenship and so on. We know that the Israeli Water Authority, which controls all the water, allocates only 3% of the water to the Palestinian population. So the majority of the population is allocated only 3% of the water. So, I mean, this is beyond clear that from the very beginning it was defined and planned as a state that was an apartheid state. But again, unless we understand this, it's impossible to move forward. There is no way to redo or undo what was done. And we're taking the West Bank and settling it with Jews and building there for Jews only, that was exactly why it was taken. It wasn't a mistake. Now, basically what they were hoping to do, and they're still hoping to do, this is a process that's still going on today, you know, some 7 decades after Israel was established and almost 50 years since they completed the occupation, is to completely erase Palestine off the map. And indeed, in Israel, there is no Palestine. The map is like this. It says Israel. They talk about the Israeli cities and towns, whether it's in the West Bank or the Galilee or anywhere else, like it's all part of the same thing. And indeed, I think it is. They've created a reality where that is the way it is. And then we have the Gaza Strip. And again, this reality that exists there, this catastrophe that it exists there, that thankfully Bernie Sanders finally admitted to and alluded to and or talked about very clearly in the last debate, it's almost talked about again. There's never any context. How did this happen? How has it happened that we had hundreds of thousands of refugees ending up there? The Gaza Strip, like the West Bank, was defined by Israel. Now, as a result of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine, they had to have a place to house all these refugees. So a line was drawn around the city of Gaza, and that is where they were pushed into. And refugee camps were built all through what was called, this thing called the Gaza Strip. And if we look, I mean, I won't read through all the stats. And again, Bernie Sanders alluded to some of them. You know, 90% of the water is not safe for drinking. You know, a large part of the population are children. The majority of the population are children and so forth. Literacy rates are very, very high. And you look at the poverty rate and the unemployment, and you look at the literacy rates, and that doesn't make sense. Usually literacy rates means, you know, that there's plenty of jobs and people are working and there's, you know, prosperity. Here we have high literacy rates and this disastrous reality. But, of course, it's imposed on them by Israel. And all of this is a result of the ethnic cleansing of 1948. If there was no ethnic cleansing of 1948, there would not have been refugees, there would not have been a Gaza Strip, there would not have been a Hamas, there would not have been any of this. But unless we connect the dots and go back to where this started, there's no context. We can never understand why we are where we are and how do we move ahead. And then we have the attacks on Gaza. Israel began attacking Gaza in the early 50s, pretty much as soon as the Gaza Strip was established. And these are pictures of Israeli commandos coming out of Gaza. Israel had several commando units And the picture over there on the end is Ariel Sharon, young Ariel Sharon. You see the knife on his belt? And these are the Israeli commandos coming out of Gaza. This is in the early 50s, after punitive operations. And the way they described it, or the way they justified it, is that there were infiltrators coming in from Gaza. And who are these infiltrators? You know, of course, we imagine all kinds of bloodthirsty Arabs coming to slaughter Jews, but mostly these were people who came to go back to their homes, to try to bring food. From time to time, they did come and commit acts of armed resistance. And then Israeli commandos would go in there and commit terrible acts of, well, massacres, really. This went on through the 50s, and then the 60s, and then the 70s. The names of the people in Gaza that justify the attacks changed. At first, they were infiltrators. Then they were Fedayeen. Then they were just plain terrorists. Now they call them Hamas. The name of the devil there is changes and evolves, and of course, the weapons evolve as well. This is what it looks like. These are the weapons Israel uses today. So whereas in the beginning they would kill a few dozens or maybe a few hundreds, today, the last attack in 2014, Israel murdered over 20 or close to 2,500 innocent civilians in broad daylight, you know. So the ability to kill has grown. The weapons are more sophisticated. But still, the question that nobody asks is, you know, why? Why is Israel attacking Gaza so consistently, so heavily, knowing full well that there hasn't ever been, and there isn't today, any threat to Israel from Gaza? There's never been a tank in Gaza. There's never been a regular army in Gaza. People in Gaza have never had even the remotest ability to threaten Israel in any way. So why are they attacking them like this? Why did they go in with these enormous punitive operations? And I think the reason is that the existence of this humanitarian catastrophe, where nearly 2 million people live, really, literally, next door to Israeli cities and towns where people live like this. I mean, you wouldn't imagine an Israeli town where there's no clean water running in the tap, there's no electricity, there's no air conditioning when it's hot. I mean, that doesn't exist where there's not plenty of food and medicine when you need it. And this is across the street from this humanitarian catastrophe. Almost 2 million people living without water that's fit for drinking. Imagine a child that needs antibiotics, and there's no antibiotics. I mean, it's that simple. Never mind the bombing and the thousands and thousands of injured that have no access to proper health care. And again, 10-minute drive from Gaza, you've got perfectly good Israeli hospitals that could treat people. But, of course, Palestinians in Gaza don't have access to that. This reality, when it sits right next to the reality in Israel, is a threat to the legitimacy of Israel. It's a threat to the narrative that illustrates Israel as a David that's fighting a Goliath. And so there are only two options. One option is to allow the people of Gaza, the refugees, to go back to their homes, to end the siege, to release the prisoners, to rebuild. But Israel doesn't want to do that. Doing nothing is not an option because people are going to ask questions. Why aren't you doing something about this? So they attack them and kill them and blame them for being terrorists, which works. And if we look as the years went by, Israel feels perfectly free to go and kill pretty much as many people as it wants in Gaza. And this excuse that they're terrorists works. In 2014, the excuse was self-defense. And how do you have to be, it's like a magic trick. You have to be a magician to convince people that dropping millions of tons of bombs on innocent civilians is somehow self-defense. But here in America, everybody talks about it. Self-defense, self-defense, self-defense. Self-defense against what exactly? And it's this image that threatens the legitimacy of the Zionist project, of the entire state of Israel. And again, this is happening every single day as we sit here today. Now, the problem with this issue is that it's not only happening in Palestine, it's happening around the world, it's happening specifically here in the United States. And one example of the persecution of Palestinians and Muslims here in America is the prosecution of what's called the Hoyland Foundation, or the Hoyland Foundation case, which is also the subject of a book I'm working on right now. And The story of the Holy Land Foundation case was the Holy Land Foundation was the largest Muslim charity organization in America. After 9/11, by an executive order, George Bush closed them down, saying that they were funneling money to Hamas, supporting a terrorist organization. According to their lawyers, and I spoke to their lawyers, this is what they said. The entire judicial system here in America was taken hostage. The Constitution, the laws, and government agency regulations were suspended. And as a result of pressure by Israel, the post-9/11 hysteria, and cowardice of the judiciary, and I'm quoting this, okay, we have a bunch of guys who did nothing wrong and were given completely insane prison sentences. Now, the three that you see here on the screen are three that I was able to visit in prison. And there are two others that I have not yet been able to visit. But this points to the fact, a very strange reality, the existence of a very strange reality, where the persecution of a people in their own land was imported here to America. And this is the Holy Land Foundation case is a very big case, and it was really a foundation of this reality. But there are other cases as well, and this is a case that I'm working on, so I know quite a bit about it. But this reality that the persecution of a people continues after they left the country from which they are kicked out, and they're trying to build a life in a new country in the new world, and their existence. And again, because their existence here and their work here as a charity trying to help Palestinians contradicts the narrative. Contradicts the legitimacy of the state of Israel, they have to be persecuted and prosecuted if possible here in the United States. And the terrorism charges were complete nonsense. Complete nonsense. I saw the prosecution file, I read through the papers. It is complete and utter nonsense, and it's unbelievable the judges saw this stuff and allowed it to continue. And we have to talk about resistance. People don't like Hamas. Hamas is terrorism, so we don't like them because they're terrorists. And any form of, any expression of resistance by Palestinians is somehow equated with terrorism. The reality is, however, I think it was expressed best by Frantz Fanon, where he said, colonialism is not a machine capable of thinking. You cannot allow this colonialist project to go on and say, well, we're actually going to restrain it by allowing a two-state solution. You can't restrain it. The project of colonizing Palestine for the Jews meant colonizing all of Palestine for the Jews, and that's it. And you can't pull it back once you've set it in motion. It is naked violence and only gives in when confronted with greater violence. Now, we know today, thankfully, because we had the experience of India, and because the Black American experience here, and the experience of South Africa, and today, specifically over the last couple of few decades, the Palestinian experience, we know that violence is not the only way. The armed struggle is not the only way to defeat colonialism and to defeat injustice. There are other ways. So there's economic pressure, there's political isolation, all of which worked in these other cases, not in Palestine yet, though. And there's the BDS, which now is being... Now there's legislation to outlaw BDS and even outlaw talking and suggesting boycott, divestment, and sanctions. So if a principled, unarmed form of resistance is illegal and armed resistance is illegal, what is exactly the expectation? That over 6 million people living in Palestine under Israeli occupation, granted the different parts of the country, they live under different laws and a different bureaucracy that governs their lives, and they're not allowed to do anything. They have to sit and negotiate, and they have to be good boys and girls. And if they dare talk about boycott, if they dare talk about isolating Israel or kicking Israel out of FIFA or pressuring artists and so forth not to go and perform in Israel, or if they dare, God forbid, to use armed resistance, all of it is bad. All of it is terrorism. All of it is, you try to legislate against all of it. It's not realistic. It's absurd. It is absolutely absurd to think that there will be no resistance. And here in the United States, there's another aspect which has really contributed to the conversation here, to raising the level of the conversation here in America, and that's Students for Justice in Palestine. They do tremendous work on campuses, unbelievable work, and the courage of these young people, many of whom are Jews, by the way. Some are Palestinians, but many of them are Jews, including, like you heard earlier, my son. You know, they have managed to fight, a very difficult fight against university administrations, against the millions and millions of dollars that are poured into this by Israel and Stand With Us and all these organizations. And this I see as definitely as part of the Palestinian resistance, and they're doing a very good job. So I think it's very important to recognize that this is what we need to support. You know, like I said earlier, do we use it peace talks or is it resistance? There's no question in my mind that as people who do care for peace and justice in Palestine need to support this resistance. The BDS movement, the Students for Justice in Palestine, and all other forms of Palestinian resistance, which are unarmed. Now, I was asked this earlier, and I get asked this all the time, is there any hope, or do I think there's any hope, or am I hopeful? And my question is this. There's no question in my mind that I am hopeful. I think we have to be hopeful. I think it's criminal to talk about this issue and not find hope. It's criminal because we're just sitting in the same place complaining all the time. It is up to us, who are rich, free, and alive all at the same time, as they say, to find hope and then act. Now, where does hope lay? Where is there hope? Is there hope in a reality that exists today where there's a state, a single state in Palestine, that offers exclusive rights to Jewish people? Or are we going to find hope in a single democracy, in a democratic state that respects human rights, that allows for equality and justice and freedom for everybody who lives within its boundaries? This is the big question. And it has nothing to do with politics. It has everything to do with values. If we accept that having a state that only gives rights to part of the population, then that's one set of values. If we believe that all people deserve equality and justice and freedom, that's a different set of values, and there's really very little to argue. Because you can't argue. These are your values, you know. And of course, my what I would support is the second option. And I'm going to leave you here with this image. This is a picture that I took in a refugee camp, Palestinian refugee camp. And let me tell you something, if any of us were living in that camp, none of us would be smiling. I can promise you that. A week in that camp, none of us would be smiling. And I think it's important for us to kind of wrap our heads around, what does it mean when we say free Palestine? What does free Palestine mean? And I would argue that a free Palestine means all of Palestine. Not a little percentage here and a little percentage there, a little piece of land here and a little piece of land there. All of Palestine, the Galilee, and the Negev Desert, and Jerusalem, and Yaffa, and the West Bank, and every other place, and of course, Gaza. Free from occupation, free from walls, free from racist laws. And if we're talking about hope, I would say that there's no question in my mind that Palestine must be free, and Palestine can be free, and if we do our job, then Palestine will be free, and much sooner than most people think. Thank you very much.
That was Miko Peled speaking at the Church Center for the United Nations in New York City. And that is our program this morning. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.
They do not believe in any entity called a devil, and they do not believe in God. It is a mistake for you to assume that they do. They are atheists in the strictest sense of the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. The US withdraws cooperation from the Russians over so-called ceasefire violations over in Syria. So as the US and Russia come closer to open war over there, we look at the air war. How would it pan out? Whose radars are best? Whose surface-to-air missiles can shoot down planes better? And is this war being used as a proving ground for World War III? Also, the drugs trade and the CIA. We have an interview with the journalist that passed away about 10 years ago. He's Gary Webb from the United States, who was investigating links between a cocaine trade and a Central Intelligence Agency. Apologies, there was no news from the Murdoch News at 6, but anyhow, Martin, we'll take full advantage of that. It gives us an extra few minutes to discuss Syria. Now, there's been a lot of accusations flying backwards and forwards, but the Americans finally pulled out, haven't they?
They have, but they claim that the Russians have violated the ceasefire agreement. But don't forget, the Americans were trying to keep the ceasefire agreement secret, because eventually the Russians insisted that it was made public. And the reason they wanted to keep it secret is because what they'd agreed was that the al-Nusra front would be separated from the rest of the so-called moderate rebels, and that then that what would then happen is that there would be joint operations by the Russians and the NATO forces against ISIS and the al-Nusra front. But the al-Nusra front are effectively in charge of eastern Aleppo. They're being armed, trained and directed by Western intelligence services, and they don't want to let them go. And there's obviously some tensions going on within the Russian within the US administration, between the Pentagon and the White House and the State Department, because they're all at cross purposes.
There are several parts of Syria that are incursions from abroad, aren't there? I mean, there's the most obvious are northern Syria, where the Turks are now ensconced, effectively annexing that part of the country, and also, of course, for many years, I think since the 67 war, the Israelis have been sitting there in the Golan Heights looking down on Syria.
Yeah, well, also, of course, British special forces were filmed inside Syria coming over from the Jordanian border. Of course, completely illegal. Those British special forces are an illegal occupation force. The Russians
bombed... Hang on a minute, because actually, look, let's just try and be realistic for a minute here, because the special forces operate really effectively outside the law, don't they? They're not actually under the purview of Parliament. They're more to do with the army.
No, I'm talking about international law, Tony. In international law, they have no right to be on Syrian soil. But they were filmed on Syrian soil. They were lucky because they were training a rebel unit, a terrorist unit, basically. The Russians then carried out an airstrike, but they warned the British special forces to get out. So they then got out of the place, and four of the terrorists they'd been training were then killed by the Russians. But of course, next time it happens, the Russians won't give a warning. They'll just kill British special forces, and British special forces will have no answer to give to this, because they're not supposed to be there, period. They're just not supposed to be there. And if they get killed when they're inside Syria, well, that's just too bad, isn't it?
Now, we're focusing a bit on the air war tonight, mainly because that is where these modern wars seem to have been won, I think, probably ever since the Battle of Britain.
Well, it's funny you mention the Battle of Britain, because if it comes to an air war over Syria, it will be like a rerun of the Battle of Britain, but the Russians and the Syrians will be playing the RAF and we will be playing the Luftwaffe. And, of course, the Russians and the Syrians have actually, between them, probably got the edge in this situation. And
well, what makes you say that?
Because they will be able to knock down planes and drones coming in. They'll be able to use electronic warfare to knock out NATO's very sophisticated electronic equipment. And they're not bluffing. And we may have to have the war now. We've reached the point where there's little point to negotiation. And it's quite possible that the Pentagon, with the bombing of the Syrian army units in Deir ez-Zor, and they've also been knocking out the bridges in Deir ez-Zor, because it's actually an enclave of civilians protected by the Syrian army, completely surrounded by ISIS, and they have been bombed. They not only bombed the Syrian army, they've also knocked out the bridges over the river inside the city in order to make it more difficult for the Syrian army to defend against the ISIS forces which are surrounding them. We haven't heard a lot about that in our media, but of course it's been covered by the Russians and others. So we're already effectively at war with Russia in Syria, and effectively this could escalate. But it's not. In the past, NATO has had overwhelming air superiority in Libya and elsewhere. But this time, they won't.
But the Russians didn't shoot down any of these American jets or the British drone
so far.
That was attacking these.
No,
Syrians?
The reason they haven't so far is because they're trying to negotiate a sensible solution. But the war party in the United States, led by Hillary Clinton and others, Ash Carter from the State Department and the war, they want a war. They're banging on about it. You've seen senior American generals this week going on, we're going to have a war with Syria, with Russia, let's get on with it. And the Russians obviously are horrified. They don't want to have a war. But a bit like Britain in 1940, they're not going to back down. And they're pretty confident that their people. Don't forget, you've got aircraft.
So you mention Ash Carter from time to time on here. I know he was actually in the Daily Mail today. Mm. Ash Carter's top aide spent $1,800 at an Italian strip club on a government credit card.
Well, yes.
So that's where your tax dollars are going, folks.
That's the least of his bad behaviour. I mean, what he and other, and Dunford, who's the head of the Pentagon at this time, when the attack took place on the Deir Azor, that went on for over an hour, and I was reading about the 82 soldiers that were killed. They came from all parts of Syria and from all communities. The majority were Sunnis, as most Syrians are, but there were plenty of Alawites and Christians who were also fighting alongside them. And, of course, that's the reality, is that the Syrian government now has the support. According to NATO's own internal reports, they estimated that about 70 to 80% of the population support the Syrian government. And, of course, they won the election 2 years ago pretty convincingly.
Yeah.
But that's totally ignored in the West. He's evil, he must go, blah, blah, blah. This is silly talk. Why they're worried is because if the Syrian army and its allies can clean al-Nusra Front, which is al-Qaeda, out of eastern Aleppo, even though they are being supported by Turkish, American and British special forces and others, then the war's virtually over. Then the rebels have lost. But they can't allow that, and they need to have a war. They're worried that Trump might win the election, and then he might start negotiating with the Russians. So the obvious thing to do is, before we get to the election, is let's get the war going, so it doesn't really matter who wins the war, who wins the election in the United States. But it's extremely dangerous and potentially a flashpoint for World War III.
Okay, South China Sea update. US-China tensions are rising after Ash Carter's comments standing aboard a US aircraft carrier. Defence Secretary Ash Carter told the US Navy sailors the country plans to sharpen our military edge in the Asia-Pacific region during an address Thursday this week. That's yesterday. An announcement came amid China's further entrenchment there in a multinational dispute over the South China Sea. The US remains the region's strongest military and security partner of choice, Carter said. While he sounds almost like he's selling himself, like G4S or something there, Carter said while speaking on the USS Carl Vinson in San Diego, CNN reported, along with creating military installations in one of the world's most important and accessible shipping channels. China's been fighting off the July ruling of the UN-backed tribunal that said it did not have absolute autonomy in the South China Sea. China called the Permanent Court of Arbitration's ruling a farce and has tried to tighten its grip on the waterway since 2012. But look, getting back to Syria, who's going to win this air war if and when it starts? Because one of the most important things is anti-aircraft missiles, and the S-400 is now in Syria and has been for a while. I mean, I know when it first arrived, the Russians were boasting, well, since the S-400 systems arrived here, the Americans haven't been flying around like they used to.
Well, indeed, and Konashev, I think it is, who's the Russian commander, was saying that if they do try and attack us, they will find that these things have got capabilities and ranges which they haven't thought about. And they were pretty shocked when they fired cruise missiles from the Caspian Sea over Iran and Iraq, because they got an agreement from the Iraqi government, who are actually on the Russian Syrian side of this.
And why do they need planes? Can't they just use cruise missiles and drones?
The thing about the cruise missiles and drones is these new Russian systems are designed to take those out. And also, they've got very, very strong electronic warfare capabilities. You've got to remember that NATO's capabilities depend very much on computers and electronics. And what the Russians have been practicing is basically knocking out the computers and electronics. So the USS Donald Cook was in the Black Sea, and the Russians just demonstrated that they could knock out its electronics completely.
Now, aren't we looking at a sort of quite a an interesting scenario here, weird and dangerous in a way, where you've got both sides saying, well, we can make a lot of political capital and possibly have an excuse to start a war if one of our planes is shot down by the Russians, or vice versa, I suppose.
Yeah, well, I think the Russians don't want war.
But it's not so. It's not. What I'm saying is, it's not so. Not so much gravitas to it if it's either a drone or a cruise missile or something.
It's not. But I mean, obviously, they're pretty angry about the attack on Deir ez-Zor because it went on for over an hour, and both the Russians and the Syrians are fairly much convinced that that was done quite deliberately by the Pentagon to undermine whatever negotiations were going on. And they don't actually trust the Americans anymore to negotiate, because Kerry was saying one thing. Meanwhile, what Dunford and the State Department were doing was something else. I think that the Russians and the Syrians are not prepared to negotiate anymore because they don't believe that the West's in good faith. They can't deliver their proxies on the ground anyway. And let's just repeat this. The people controlling eastern Aleppo are al-Qaeda. They are the people that we've supposedly spent the last 15 years and millions of deaths to defeat. And yet we are supporting them with weapons, including anti-tank weapons, including anti-aircraft weapons, in order to defeat Assad, who's the elected leader of Syria, and the Russians, who are a democracy, far more of a democracy than many Western states.
Well, there's been loads
are.
And loads of coverage night after night about Aleppo, blow by blow, but very, very little talk about places like Sana'a in Yemen.
Indeed. And also, of course, they're not mentioning the fact that most of the population of Aleppo is actually in the in western part of Aleppo, which is controlled by the government. They've got 1.5 million people there, but the rebels, the terrorists, are firing indiscriminately at the civilian areas of Aleppo. And they're also using the people in eastern Aleppo as human shields. And there was a discussion by Misurata, who's Italian, I think, from the UN, saying, well, why don't al-Qaeda, al-Nusra in Aleppo leave? We can arrange for them to go. We will bring UN people in and they can leave with their weapons and just leave. And the Russians said, this is interesting, that would be good. Why don't they just go? But they're not prepared to go. And they're also because they're being backed up by the British government and the US government. We are backing al-Qaeda in eastern Aleppo, and they're no doubt being trained by British special forces.
And tonight, as we speak, the Russians are facing,
as they always have
facing
been.
Pressure to stop the bombardment of Aleppo. Russia said on Friday a draft UN resolution for a truce in the Syrian city of Aleppo was unacceptable as Moscow faced growing international pressure to stop the devastating bombardment of the city backed by Russian air power. Russia's Deputy Foreign Minister, Gennady Gatilov, said a draft put forward by France contained a number of unacceptable points, politicised the issue of humanitarian aid. But Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Russia would support an eye-catching proposal by UN Syria envoy Staffan de Mistura to escort militants out of Aleppo personally. Russia was ready to call on the Syrian government to allow fighters from the Islamic al-Nusra front to leave the city. So, Martin, this is just literally at the moment they're discussing all this. It doesn't sound to me as if the Americans have really got the... I mean, they're saying at the UN, we want to stop this, but would they ever shoot these Russian jets down?
Who would shoot them down?
The Americans.
Yes, potentially, yes. I mean, they're basically saying, some US general was saying this week, we will beat you heavier than you've ever been beaten or whatever. The rhetoric from the American side, if you look at Samantha Power, when they were called to the UN after the attack at Deir ez-Zor, she didn't even bother to go into the meeting. She just talked to the media and ranted and raved about how the Russians were this, that and the other, totally ignoring the fact that the British, the RAF and the Americans had killed 82 soldiers. What would we do if the Syrians had killed 82 British soldiers? What would we do about that? Would we say, oh, well, never mind, it was just an accident?
Tonight, as part of this discussion at the UN Security Council, that Russia is saying that it would allow Islamist Nusra Front, this is the Sham Liberation Front they supposedly changed their name to, but no one seems to have taken much notice of that, to leave the city with their weapons, said Sergei Lavrov. But unfortunately, al-Nusra Front say they don't trust Assad, and so they're not going to agree to it.
Well, that's a fundamental problem, isn't it? Are these people under control? Can they be given orders by the West? Not necessarily. But in any case, if the West were to tell them to leave, they might just go. But they're not being told to leave. They've lost the war in Syria effectively, and don't forget it was the West that started the war.
I mean, how important is Aleppo in all of this?
It's very important if you look at its location. It's absolutely key to keeping open the supply lines from Turkey.
But even if Aleppo is liberated, you've then got problems up in the north of Syria, haven't you?
Well, you've got the Turks who've taken over a bit of chunk of Syria, but of course they've got no right to be there any more than the Israelis have got a right to be in the Golan Heights. And ultimately, Assad has said we are going to liberate every centimetre of our territory.
Some people might see Syria as a trap into which the Russians have now fallen inexorably.
They're
never going to be able to leave there. Well, and they're going to be fighting forever.
Well, I mean, did you see there was an American general whose name I've forgotten who said, "Well, what the Russians have got to take account of here is they might lose aircraft, they might have body bags with their soldiers in, there might be attacks on Russian cities." Now, that's been interpreted by the Russians as a threat by the Americans to shoot their planes down, kill their soldiers, and attack their cities. And do you know what? They're not impressed. And they're not going to back down.
Well, it might happen, mightn't it? If this resolution doesn't go through the UN, it just looks as if it won't go through. The Americans are saying, you've got to stop this bombardment now.
Well, they're not going to. And they've also got to decide, in that case, what they're going to do. Now, what can they do? Well, they could try and set up a no-fly zone. That's what's been talked about, a no-fly zone. Now, what that means is they've got to smash the Syrian-Russian air defences. Now, they might have the Israelis to help them. They might have, it'll be mostly the US with, the British hanging around like lapdogs as they normally do. But it's not at all clear that they would win that Battle of Syria. It would be very similar to the Battle of Britain, because I think that the technical edge is with the Russian side. And don't forget that they will be able to knock out aircraft carriers in the Mediterranean, for example. They have the Iskander missile. They've been moving their destroyers from the Black Sea. And it could be, a whole aircraft carrier or more could go down with 30,000 dead.
There's been a massive news story this week, I would consider massive, which has hardly got any coverage at all, as usual, in the London media, which is Bell Pottinger are in the spotlight for creating propaganda videos for the US military in Iraq. Now, this goes all the way back to 2004. Bell Pottinger, the PR company, created propaganda videos in Iraq on behalf of the US government in a contract worth more than $500 million over several years, according to revelations unearthed by the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. Well done, folks. The work included creating short news segments made to look like Arabic news networks and fake insurgent videos. Sunday Times, which worked with the Bureau on the investigation, and other news outlets reported this weekend. That's just the weekend just gone. The scale of Bell Pottinger's operation in Iraq was significant, costing on average more than $100 million a year, with the agency at one point employing almost 300 British and Iraqi staff. Bell Pottinger made about £15 million a year in fees from the work. Agency founder Lord Bell told the Sunday Times, with a bulk of the money going on costs such as production and distribution. The agency's work started in Iraq in March 2004, when it was tasked with promotion of democratic elections. But the Bureau said it identified transactions worth £420 million between the Pentagon and Bell Pottinger relating to contracts issued from May 2007 to December 2011, with a contract worth a similar annual rate reportedly in force in 2006 too. Bell Pottinger's employee Martin Wells said his work consisted of three types of products: TV ads portraying Al-Qaeda in a negative light, news items made to look as if they'd been created by Arab TV and with the origins sometimes hidden, and the production of fake Al-Qaeda propaganda films. Martin.
Yes, so in other words, when we see on our TV screens what is supposedly an Al-Qaeda video of beheading or whatever it is, the fact is we know that this was actually probably created with our own taxes in order to bamboozle us to believe that this is a genuine video. And this is all called psychological warfare. But of course, the psychological warfare is against the population of the Western countries, who are being basically fed a diet of distorted and downright deceptive information by their own intelligence services companies.
What this chap working for Bell Pottinger said was that this Bell Pottinger also carried out some work under the Joint Psychological Operations Task Force, which a US defense official confirmed but declined to give details of. He said their work was signed off by the commander of coalition forces in Iraq, General Petraeus, although some of it went higher up the command chain and was approved by the White House Bell, who in August announced his departure from the agency to form a new venture, Sans Frontières, told the Sunday Times he was proud of Bell Pottinger's work in Iraq. Now, I wonder if his departure had anything to do with this forthcoming release of this work by the Bureau of Investigative Journalists.
Well, it's a wonder, isn't it? I mean, basically, organisations like Bell Pottinger are paid by the intelligence services to basically put out fraudulent information, which is then used to bamboozle the population to support policies they otherwise wouldn't support.
I mean, what
and
this
has all been paid for by our taxes.
Martin, what does this tell us about the news that's on our television tonight? Never mind about 2004,
well, indeed,
up
well,
until 2012
well,
this
I think
was going
what
on.
We can presume is when we look at the BBC or any mainstream news outlet and they give us a clip of supposedly independent information about what's going on, that in actual fact, more than likely, we can presume that that clip has actually been fabricated by an intelligence service.
I wonder,
and for example, for the Aleppo convoy that was supposedly attacked by the Russians in the air.
Things like these beheading videos, of course, from last year. Very, you know, very, very suspicious.
Indeed.
But, I mean, this has been going on up until 2012 by this particular company. Effectively, that's at least 8 years we know about here. I'm sure it is still going on. This is just propaganda that
Well, it is. I mean, but it's black propaganda. Don't forget, we are presented with videos which supposedly come from ISIS and Al-Qaeda, etc., and it turns out that they don't. And, of course, don't forget that ISIS and Al-Qaeda are, in fact, being run by intelligence services anyway. The Russians and the Syrians are completely convinced that ISIS and Al-Qaeda, Al-Nusra,
well, I came
are
across,
being armed and trained
I
by the Western intelligence services.
I came across a fairly new news agency, English language news agency from Iran this week, called El Alam, which I'll put a link to this on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The web address is alalam.ir. And El Alam are saying only Sunni Muslims can live in Mosul. Now, this is literally this morning. A speech by President Erdogan is now saying that only Sunnis will be able to live in northern Iraq.
Well, exactly. And also the Iraqi government have told the Turks to get their forces out of Iraq because they're not there on invitation. And they said that they may go to war with them. Incidentally, of course, we're talking about what's going on in Aleppo and how terrible it is. We're not mentioning anything about Yemen, but we're not mentioning anything about Iraq. There's just about to be an assault on various places in Iraq, which is exactly the same as what's going on in Aleppo, except that the people doing the assault on the rebels there are the Iraqi government and NATO forces.
The Turkish
using
president,
exactly the same tactics as the Russians.
The Turkish president made no reference to Mosul's indigenous population of Iraqi Christians, predominantly ethnic Assyrians, who have maintained a Christian presence in the city for centuries, since the earliest days of the church, forced into a rapid exodus when ISIS stormed into Mosul in June 2014. Most of these displaced Iraqi Christians still live as internal refugees in the Ankawa enclave in northern Iraq's Erbil city. So what it sounds to me is if Erdogan is saying that Sunni Muslims only, nobody else is allowed in this city. How on earth can you say that?
Well, because this used to be the Ottoman Empire, and Erdogan wants to rebuild it. And in actual fact, the Iraqi government based in Baghdad, our allies, remember, they've told the Turks, who are part of NATO, to get out of Iraq, otherwise they're going to go to war with them. Another flashpoint that nobody's taking any notice about.
Well, nobody's got a peace prize today for the Middle East. There's no surprise there. In fact, it was the Colombian president, Juan Manuel Santos, who's got the Nobel Peace Prize for his peace efforts in Colombia, even though this peace deal has been rejected.
The Nobel Prize Committee have probably done a reasonable job there. Santos has done his best to try and bring peace to Colombia. He's been frustrated by Uribe, the previous president, who is himself associated with the notorious paramilitaries and narco-traffickers from Alto Unidas Defensas de Colombia. And if you look at the breakdown of the votes in Colombia, the areas which have been most affected by FARC are the areas which have voted for peace. And the areas in which FARC has been basically another opposition has been eliminated by the paramilitaries associated with the previous president Uribe. They're the ones who have voted to against the agreement. But I don't think it's finished yet. I think both Santos and FARC are determined to continue with this peace process. And I don't think there's any. Thankfully, there's no real danger of a return.
Well,
to
one of the other
war.
People or groups nominated, because you can apparently even the EU won it. I think won the Nobel Peace Prize 1 year is. the White Helmets were nominated. But, Martin, they are really just a kind of psychological warfare tool themselves.
Well, the White Helmets won the Right Livelihood Award, which is pretty disgusting, really, which was set up by Jacob von Uxkull, who I used to work with when I worked at New Economics Foundation. The White Helmets are massively funded by the British, the EU,
unpaid, unarmed, the individuals that volunteer for
it. But the organisation itself is massively funded. £28 million, I think, they got from the British taxpayer last year. And their job is to go around taking photographs of shocking scenes in order to get us to realise how terrible
and
the Russians are.
And rescuing survivors from bomb sites. Can I just comment on that?
There is, in fact, a proper civil defence force in Syria. And Victoria...
In the government-controlled areas.
Victoria Beely is going to be speaking in Bristol next week. She's a journalist. I've got a thing about it. We perhaps put it on the show page. The White Helmets, when you look at the photographs of what they're doing, they're not, in fact, trained to do any of this. Their main function is to take photographs of shock horror stuff and then push it out to the Western media to say, isn't it terrible, all the stuff that's going on? So they're basically a psychological warfare outfit, and they were set up by James Le Mesurier, who's an ex-British psychological warfare officer based in Turkey. And they have a massive amount of funding from us, from the taxpayer. We've just been talking about Bell Pottinger being funded by the taxpayer to make up videos by Al-Qaeda. The White Helmets are funded by the taxpayer, by us, in order to tell us how terrible the Russians are. That's their role. They're embedded with Al-Nusra Front. And the picture of the boy that was covered in dust and all the rest of it, the guy who took that picture was then photographed with the other militants chatting and joking with them, and these militants were the ones who chopped the head off the Palestinian 12-year-old and made a video of it, which went round the world. Of course, it wasn't shown on our screens. Because that's not what we need to know. And what's happening is a concerted attempt to distort the truth about what's going on in Syria, and the White Helmets are very much part of that. They're a concept created by PR and psychological warfare specialists.
But they're also helping people out of bomb sites. They're not just a concept.
I dispute that. In actual fact, it's quite likely they are embedded with Al-Nusra. And so they took the photographs of the so-called the convoy that was supposedly attacked by Russian air forces, although the UN have now run back on that and said, well, it was attacked, but we don't know by who. And I think that the attack on the convoy was carried out by Al-Nusra. Then the White Helmets take a film of it and say the Russians did this. What the White Helmets are frequently doing is they're taking pictures of people who've been killed by their own side and saying, oh, look, the Russians and the Syrians have killed these people. And in actual fact, they've been doing this all along. All of the rebels in Syria have been killing lots and lots of people they regard as their enemies, you know, Alawites, Christians, people who aren't Sunni Muslims. And then they say, then they take photographs of it. When you see a photograph of a dead body can't tell you who killed them. And that's what they're doing. They're taking photographs of dead bodies that they've killed themselves, and then saying, oh, look, this is terrible. This is what's going on here.
A quick correction, it's not Victoria Beely, it's Vanessa Beely.
Vanessa Beely.
And maybe you could tell us when she's actually coming to
Bristol. Well, it's actually in my pocket. I've got it in the pocket of my jacket over here, so I'll have to do...
Okay, well, we'll do that before the end of the hour. But just a couple of corrections from last week's show. I always try and do these. Any inaccuracies you hear or any complaints you've got, do go on to our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where you can comment on this show, put links, if you have got a correction, please do put a link in to show us where the correct information is. A couple of things I picked up myself on last week's, sorry to have made these errors, but anyway, I did say last week that there were 29 Conservative MPs who were being investigated for fraudulent elections from May 2015. In fact, the total is 31 Conservative MPs who are being investigated for fraudulent election returns from May 2015 across the country by something like 16, 17 different police forces, including our own Avon and Somerset force. It's a long time to have waited before this has been properly looked at and any charges are brought. The other one, though, was we did an item last week, do the world's super rich worship a god, and if so, which one? The actual speaker was Dr. Stanley Monteith, not Eustace Mullins, as I incorrectly said. But anyway, Martin, let's go back now to the Syria topic, because it was something, international affairs, that came up at the Conservative Party conference as well this week, with the new Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson putting his oar in.
And if you look at the course of events in the last 10 years, then I'm afraid you can make the case that it is partly as a result of that lack of Western self-confidence, political, military, economic, that in some material ways the world has gotten less safe, more dangerous, and more worrying. After a long post-war period in which the world was getting broadly more peaceful, the number of deaths in conflict has risen from 49,000 in 2010 to 167,000 last year. The global number of refugees is up by 30% on 2013, up to 46 million last year. And of course, much of that crisis in refugees can be attributed to the war in Syria. It is part of a wider arc of instability that sweeps across from Iraq to Libya. And this matters profoundly to our country, because it is the continuing savagery of the Assad regime against the people of Aleppo and the complicity of the Russians in committing what are patently war crimes, bombing hospitals when they know they are hospitals and nothing but hospitals, that is making it impossible for peace negotiations to resume, and that is prolonging a migration crisis that last year overwhelmed Europe's ability to cope. And when the violent extremism of Daesh is erupting across the face of the Middle East, we are inevitably seeing the contagion spread to cities in Germany, France, Belgium, and of course here in our country as well. And if that threat to travel continues to have a palpable chilling effect on tourism, perhaps even on trade, then for a great trading nation like Britain, that is a matter of deep concern.
Well, I mean, what we got from Boris Johnson there is the usual rubbish about Syria, what's happening in Syria. It's the dreadful Assad, the Assad that got a massive election victory 2 years ago, overwhelmingly supported by all communities in Syria. He's actually grown into the role of being president of Syria. Many of the people who opposed him in the streets in 2011 have come back round to supporting him, because they see him as a bulwark against exactly the kind of extremists that the Western intelligence services and armed forces have been supporting. There was no mention there by Boris Johnson of the 82 Syrian soldiers killed partly by the RAF 2 weeks ago. It's completely distorted. And, of course, he's going on about eastern Aleppo. There's all sorts of other violence going on in Syria, carried out by the rebels, but it's eastern Aleppo they're focusing on, because that's where the war will be won or lost. And I'm quite sure that the Syrians and the Russians have now reached the point where they're not prepared to negotiate anymore. They want the war over, and that means that they've got to win in Aleppo.
So, I mean, ultimately this is all being finished off because the Russians have taken command of the air. Do you think they're going to have that for the foreseeable future, or will the Americans start to contest?
Well, we discussed this earlier. Right. And I think that the Russians are very cautious. They certainly didn't intervene in Ukraine.
The question is, will the Americans contest this?
Well, the question is, will they contest it? I think they might, but if they do, they'll lose. And this is what the Russians have been trying to do all along. They've been trying to put the US general staff in the position where whatever they would like to do, the reality is they can't do it because they haven't got the power. And you've seen both Dempsey and Flynn, senior military figures in the US, who've deserted the ship, because they basically said, well, we're supporting ISIS and al-Nusra, why are we doing this? And we can't possibly win. And so what the Russians are demonstrating with their kit produced by their nationalised arms industry is superior to NATO kit. kit, because it's a lot of NATO kit basically is junk, well, created for profit.
Over the last 30, 40 years, in fact, it was a completely secret program for something like 10 years up until the first Gulf War, I believe, was when the first jet stealth bombers and stealth fighters were revealed by the US. It was interesting. I was having a chat to a British engineer who used to work for Plessy's earlier on this week, and he said that the UK pioneered the whole idea of having a stealth fighter, stealth bomber, stealth aircraft back in 1947, but quickly realised that a physically separated transmitter and receiver radar would defeat it, so they dropped it. And actually this is called something called a bistatic radar, and that much of the money that's been spent on stealth technology, he believes, is completely wasted, because the technology by late 1940s had got beyond the wartime radar, and they realised that stealth was not going to work.
Yeah, well, the point I would make is that the Russian arms industry has been retooled. It's still run by the government for the government, so nobody makes any profit out of making weaponry in Russia. That's why they don't waste a single ruble. Whereas what you've got things like the F-35 in the United States, massively expensive, massively over budget, and basically rubbish.
Because this radar and
the more
like
money
this
you spend on stuff, the better.
But there's
it
also
is.
Something we're being bamboozled, surely, because this stuff is so top secret, they're able to pull the wool over the eyes of the people sitting on the political committees that are funding it.
Well, don't forget, they're also paying for the campaigns of the people sitting on those committees. And we had Media Benjamin speaking from the US in Bristol last night at a Stop the War meeting, and she was saying, well, in every constituency, congressional district in the US, they've got a factory producing weaponry, and they make sure that's the case, so that every single congressperson has to support the military industry, because it's all in their constituencies. But what it leads to is massive overspending on military goods, which are of substandard. The Russian socialist system, if you like, where if you're going to produce weapons, we're not going to do this in the private sector, we're not going to do this as make a profit, we are just going to produce the weapons that our military needs to do what it needs to do.
Let's get into a bit of this military technology now. The article is something called the militaryaerospace.com site, article by John Keller. The headline is Stealth Detecting Bistatic Radar is Back in the News. He also talks about something else as well in this, another kind of parallel technology to this. Bill Sweetman wrote on the Aviation Week Defence Technology blog this month of a formerly secret project to defend Swedish airspace against stealth cruise missiles with a bistatic radar approach called the Associative Aperture Synthesis Radar, AASR. This AASR programme was cancelled in 2000 because at the time experts no longer considered cruise missiles to be a threat, amazingly. US bistatic radar and other anti-cruise missile programs have fallen by the wayside as well, as research dollars have shifted to other priorities. Well, it doesn't seem as if the people who are making decisions in the Western world about how defence money is spent really know, because so much of this is top secret. They aren't in the best position to assess what the threat is. The military
are. The basic logic of what goes on is, in the West, the military-industrial complex is out of control. And in actual fact, they want to buy the most expensive systems, the most complex systems, the ones that cost the most, because the more money you spend on weaponry, the more profit is made by Boeing, by BAE Systems, by Rolls-Royce, whoever. And it's all geared around making profits for those companies. It's not driven by military.
Is this the reason,
military,
though, the Russians have had the confidence to take and hold the air superiority in Syria?
That's because they know that their kit is produced. The Russians are in a very difficult position. Every ruble they spend on military is money that they can't spend on schools, hospitals, roads in Russia. So they're very careful about how they spend their money, because there's no profit to be made from it, apart from selling on to third countries. But that means that, in fact, the generals are in charge of the policy in Russia. In the West, the people in charge of the policy are the CEOs of the military-industrial complex. And, of course, they're not soldiers.
Well, something called the Joint Strike Fighter is supposed to be taking over from most of our military jets in the US. In fact, many countries in NATO, including the Australians. And a few years ago, on the ABC channel over there, they did a report on the effectiveness of the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter. So I thought we'd have a listen to that now. now, because there's been we've done reports, it's sort of a bugbear of mine, really. I call it the scam jet of the century, that fantastic amounts of money are being spent on this, and one of the great advocates for it, for whatever reason, was George Osborne, who's now out of the way. So we'll see if he's still, or if the programme is still going to be there for the British military to buy this plane. Anyway, this is what ABC in Australia, and specifically their programme, ABC Late Line, with the reporter Connor Duffy, made of the F-35, the Joint Strike Fighter, which the British are committed to buying so many of.
Mastery of the skies doesn't come cheap.
The F-35 Joint Strike Fighter is a highly diversified fifth-generation tactical aircraft.
But for $20 billion, you'd hope to come close. Back when the RAAF signed on to the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter program in 2002, the jet's makers dubbed it Lightning, promising it would revolutionise air combat and secure Australia's defence needs for decades.
The F-35 displays its lethal spectrum of air superiority as the next generation fighter for America and its allies.
But now an early review is in, and the JSF has been shot down.
If Australia goes ahead with the Joint Strike Fighter purchase, the RAAF will be ineffective for the next 30 to 40 years.
The RAND Corporation in the United States prepared an analysis of the JSF's ability to match rival Russian and Chinese jets in close-range combat. The results were damning. The report says the JSF is
double inferior relative to modern Russian-Chinese fighter designs in visual range combat,
and has
inferior acceleration, inferior climb, inferior sustained turn capability.
It concludes that the JSF
can't turn, can't climb, can't run.
I think it's very damning. It makes very clear that in comparison to the Sukhoi, within visual range combat, to use their terminology, the JSF is doubly inferior.
The RAND analysis was prepared before a simulated war game exercise called Pacific Vision that was held at a Hawaiian airbase in August. Five Australian defence personnel took part in the exercise. Now there are suggestions that the results of those war games are just as scathing of the Joint Strike Fighter. In the mock battle, the JSF, F-22 and Super Hornets were dubbed the Blue Team and had to defend an attack by a red team made up of Russian-built Sukhoi fighters. The results are classified, but Lateline has obtained an email from a former RAAF flight test engineer who says he has been briefed on the exercise. In late August, Peter Goon, who is in regular correspondence with Defence, wrote to the head of the Defence Material Organisation, Dr. Steve Gumley, and the Defence Minister, saying that the results of Pacific Vision were disastrous for the JSF.
Red Force dominated the exercise, going up against two versions of Blue Force, both of which were roundly defeated. One way the Red Force summation of events has been described is that it was like clubbing baby seals. In addition to this rather blunt Red Force summation, the wargaming exercise demonstrated the JSF aircraft were next to useless, while the Super Hornets of both Blue Forces were seriously and significantly overmatched, a.k.a. useless. Hundreds of Blue Force aircraft were lost in the first 20 minutes.
Liberal backbencher Dr. Dennis Jensen says the email warning is credible.
Yes, I think it is. Certainly from the results that I've heard from the Pacific Vision exercise, bore out very much the analysis that RAND Corporation had in their pre-brief.
But a leading defence analyst is not convinced by the email and says the Pacific Vision exercise wasn't about comparing the two jets.
I don't think it's credible that the JSF came up as badly as some rumours are having it in this exercise.
Andrew Davies says he's seen unclassified simulations from the plane's manufacturer, Lockheed Martin.
It was showing that the JSF would, in the majority of cases, defeat an aircraft like a Sukhoi, well beyond visual range.
He says the constant sniping at the JSF project is causing frustration in Air Force ranks. Connor Duffy, Lateline.
That's, as I said, Connor Duffy there from ABC News in Australia. Martin, also more recent news on the F-35. They're saying that the peeling and crumbling of the insulation on the planes is causing problems. That's in the Washington Post, and also on the nationalinterest.org, news is that this is just literally this week, almost a squadron's worth of Joint Strike Fighters Inside Defence are saying may not fly for months, as Colin Clark wrote for Breaking Defence. US Air Force and Royal Norwegian Air Force have suspended flight operations for 15 of these F-35s, 13 American and 2 Norwegian ones, after finding peeling and crumbling insulation in the avionics cooling lines between the fuel tanks. Doesn't sound very healthy. And are these things actually up to the job?
Well, the answer is probably no, and the reason is, as we've just been suggesting, the whole drive of Western policy is to spend as much money as possible in order to keep the profits of the arms industry up. That doesn't mean that you end up with kit which is actually usable, and it doesn't mean that you're going to win the follow-on wars that you're going to fight with them.
Well, the wider future for Syria, is it now a done deal then? The Russians, if the Americans don't have the kit to really intervene in the air over there, well, certainly with actual aircraft, they may have anti-aircraft missiles and that sort of thing. Is it almost all over with Aleppo and it's just really northern Syria and the Golan Heights
I would like to think so. I mean, what we really need to see now is a rapid end to the war with the defeat of the mostly foreign factions like al-Nusra and Daesh, who don't actually who have no interest in a solution. And the Russians have also been talking to other factions and saying, look, we are willing to negotiate with people who have taken up arms against the Syrian government. We know you've got legitimate grievances, but the time has come for us all to call a ceasefire and settle and create a government of national unity led by Assad. Now, that's not acceptable to the West, it's not acceptable to the Israelis, it's not acceptable to Hillary Clinton, but the fact is they can't win the war. They've done enough to make the poor old Syrians suffer miserable circumstances for years. And, of course, Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, was on French television some years ago saying that he was approached before the war began by British officials who said, we are going to start an armed uprising in Syria. I noticed that Boris Johnson didn't mention any of that in his little speech to the Conservative Party conference, that the British have had the finger pointed at them by Sarkozy's foreign minister, that you started the war. So all the people that have died and all the destruction and all the death and all of the misery, we started it.
Okay, back to the White Helmets and Syria. Finally, Martin, the White Helmets, Al-Qaeda with a facelift, is a four-minute video on YouTube which reveals the truth, supposedly, about the grouping. The Syria Solidarity Movement, including Ava Bartlett, Vanessa Bealey, Ken Stone, and Hands Off Syria, which made the videos, extensively researched White Helmets' funding and their role. And you were mentioning that Vanessa Bealey herself, who has been to Syria, I understand, will be here in Bristol next week. So,
yeah,
what's...
There's a Bristol Open Inquiry into the UK bombing of Syria, public meeting at the ARC, which is 27 Broad Street, Bristol, BS1 2HG. It's Friday the 4th of November, so it's not next Friday, Friday the 4th of November at 7 o'clock, and it costs £3.72. You have to go on Eventbrite to get a ticket. But Vanessa Bealey has been extensively all over Syria. There's another chap called Reverend Andrew Ashdown, who I believe is a British priest who's been over there. And we're being told a load of lies about what's going on there. You need to listen to people who have actually been on the ground.
It sounds to me like, although Bell Pottinger don't have that particular contract anymore, someone else does.
Well, indeed. We're basically being told a load of fibs all the time, and basic factual information about what's been happening there has been denied to people, including, as I said, Roland Dumas, the French foreign minister, pointing the finger at the British for starting the whole war in the first place by beginning an armed uprising. And I think that's pretty much what's happened. The protests of 2011 were weaponised by Western intelligence services and special forces quite deliberately, but they just weren't able to achieve their goal of overthrowing Assad in the way that they overthrew Gaddafi. And of course, we've just had the report by the Commons Select Committee on Libya, which basically said that everything we were told about Libya, there was going to be a massacre in Benghazi and all the rest of it, all rubbish.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol.
Now, Martin, we're moving on to go back actually to the Conservative Party conference now to hear a little bit from our local MP, Liam Fox, who's the International Trade Minister. And a part of his speech was a very empty hall, only about maybe a third or a quarter full. But Liam Fox was talking about international trade. Really, there's two, aren't there? There's David Davis, who's the Brexit Minister, and him is the new International Trade Minister or Secretary. And he's got his own marvellous new department. So, in a way, these two, as David Davis is trying to get the best deal from Europe, Liam Fox is out there trying to get the best deal from the rest of the world.
Now, while we remain inside the European Union, we are bound by its rules not to negotiate any new trade agreements, as Boris repeatedly reminds me. But we are able to discuss the impediments that we might wish to eliminate ahead of agreements that we might reach with other countries when we leave. And that's why you will hear even the most fervent advocates of a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom reiterating that they have to deal with the EU first. And as long as we remain a member, we will push continually for EU agreements that open up global trade, such as CETA, the EU trade agreement with Canada. Their prosperity increases our prosperity, and a more open global market can genuinely be a win-win for us all. And both while we remain in the EU and after we leave, we will continue to push the case for Britain as a great place to do business. Now, in case any of you haven't noticed, the sky didn't fall down on the 24th of June. For instead of investors fleeing the UK, we've seen a record amount of inward investment. We saw the $24 billion investment by the Japanese company SoftBank in Cambridge, as well as a host of others, including Apple and GSK. And why does investment come to Britain? It comes because we have many natural advantages, advantages that we will continue to exploit. We have a system of law, including commercial law, that is admired across the whole world. We have a skilled workforce, low levels of industrial disruption, low regulation, low taxation, some of the best universities in the world, a strong research base. We speak English and we're in the right time zone for global trading. Why would anyone not want to invest in this country?
Well, it's whistling in the dark, really. I mean, what he's saying is, yes, we're going to be all right, it's going to be fine. But the fact he mentioned the Canadian trade agreement there, and he certainly
this is CETA, S-I-T-A.
Yes, and actually, I've got a little note about this here. If you like TTIP, you'll love CETA. Now, in actual fact, I'd like to know from Liam Fox, are we going to sign up to TTIP? Because that's what Hillary Clinton wants, that's what Donald Trump wants, that's what Angela Merkel wants, but if we sign up to TTIP, we'll be in exactly the same position as the rest of the EU, in which EU regulations will be merged with Canadian and American regulations, and we'll all have to work with those regulations. Or is Britain, having left the EU, not going to sign up to TTIP? In actual fact, the EU isn't going to sign up to TTIP because the French are opposed, and so are many Germans. So, but as I understand it, Liam Fox mentioned that he was in favour of CETA, so he must be in favour of TTIP. But what that means is that we will have to have EU regulations by the back door via TTIP. There's no such thing as a free market out there. It's a fantasy. Everybody is part of some organisation or other that determines the rules of the market that they're in. There is no free market apart from that. So if Britain's going to leave the EU, are we going to leave TTIP and CETA as well? Or are we going to sign up for that, in which case we might as well not have bothered to leave the EU?
We are Bristol's first community radio station. BCFM 93.2.
Our final item tonight, Gary Webb. Martin, do you want to say something about him? Because he was an investigative journalist in the West Coast US who was looking into all sorts of connections between the CIA and drug dealing.
Yeah, he was the one. He was the journalist that used to work with Mike Rupert, the police officer, that exposed the fact that the Iran-Contra affair and Colonel Oliver North, who was running it all, basically they were funding the Contra rebels in Nicaragua, who killed 30,000 civilians, mostly women and children, with cocaine from Colombia, which was being brought into the U.S. via MENA Air Base in Arkansas when Hillary and Bill were in the governor's mansion there. And Gary Webb exposed all of this. And there's been a film made about it called Dark Alliance, I think, a Hollywood film. But he then eventually committed suicide by shooting himself twice in the back of the head, as you do if you're an American investigative journalist.
Investigative reporting is being sort of squeezed out of the picture, and I think intentionally. because it tends to ruffle feathers. I mean, good investigative reporting does ruffle feathers. It draws lawsuits and it gets newspapers in trouble.
Old pirates, yes, they rob I, sold I to the merchant ship.
My name is Gary Webb. I am an investigative journalist. I've been an investigative journalist for about 25 years for daily newspapers. And in 1996, I wrote a series of stories entitled Dark Alliance, which was about CIA involvement in drug trafficking. What my story showed was that the cocaine that was being sold in those neighborhoods was coming from mainly one source, and this one source was being used to finance a guerrilla war in Central America. The general idea of the CIA dealing drugs was something that the American mainstream press had never written about before, and that's why it prompted outrage among blacks, among drug reform activists, among politicians, by the CIA, by every federal agency involved in the drug war, because it showed they weren't doing their jobs, that it was a fraud. Right after we published the stories, the support we got from the media was very favorable. Newsweek magazine did a big piece on the story and said it was well documented and well researched. The website was getting like a million hits a day. There were marches in Watts, there were marches in Compton, there were candlelight vigils. Every California senator demanded an official investigation. So the story itself is really building momentum. The government reaction was no reaction. And this, I believe, was a very careful strategy, because nobody was going to believe the government if they came out and said we didn't do it. The proof was fairly overwhelming, since we had all these government documents showing that it had happened. So what happened was they let the so-called liberal press speak for them. And they had the national security reporters at the Washington Post, who coincidentally used to work for the CIA, write stories saying it doesn't mean anything.
That's the voice of Gary Webb there. I'll put links up to that complete thing, the Dark Alliance. Gary Webb was working at something called the San Jose Mercury News in California when he so-called committed suicide. Anyway, time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock.
Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. I am Malihe Razazan.
And I'm Khalil Bendib.
Without stopping the role of the outside forces and the support of the regional powers, including allies of the United States, it would be wishful thinking to assume that the civil war is going to stop in its own. And the people can't do much because people don't have guns, they don't have arms. And Libya is awash with guns, but in the hands of the wrong groups.
This week we'll have a conversation with University of New England political scientist Professor Ali Ahmida about the political and humanitarian crisis in Libya. Later in the program, we'll hear the first part of an interview with Hussein Khalili, a Palestinian activist and co-founder of the Symbiosis Art Festival, which promotes cross-cultural collaboration between the local community on the island of Lesbos, the transient refugee population, and international activists and volunteers. All this coming up on this week's Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Today, more than 5 years after the toppling of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi, the situation in Libya has arrived at political and territorial chaos. ISIS holds territory in the central part of the country. Former rebels have continued fighting over territory and political power, and the country has become a transit station for hundreds of thousands of desperate African refugees on their perilous sea journey to Europe. Khalil spoke with Ali Ahmida, chair of the Political Science Department at University of New England and author of the Making of Modern Libya, about the ongoing political and territorial chaos in Libya.
Professor Hamida, welcome back to Voices of the Middle East and North Africa. It's great to have you with us again.
Well, thank you very much, Khalid. It has been a while.
Professor Hamida, the last time we had you on, about 3 years ago, if I remember correctly, things seemed a bit more hopeful in Libya. This was before the political and security situation substantially deteriorated, and Libya is now seemingly in some form of chaos. And many now actually rue the day when Gaddafi was ruling this country with a bloody iron hand. So the country has had elections. It seemed to be headed towards normalization before it imploded into this incredible array of different militarized factions all over the country, none of which seemed interested in surrendering their arms and power. How did this happen in a country that until 2011 seemed, at least on the surface, like a united sovereign entity?
Khalid, this is a very sad story, unfortunately. And I think looking back at the situation in 2011, it was very, very positive and full of hope. I remember, I think we talked about it. I said to myself, this is really a contentious situation. But I had no illusion that there are a lot of challenges ahead. Unfortunately, despite the very, very outstanding early months of the uprising and the courage and the optimism of the Libyan people who participated in three elections, the first election in 2012, the elections later on in 2013, and for the parliament and also the constitutional assembly or commission, which was observed by many, many independent representatives from regional organizations, the UN, and also many observers, was very, very refreshing and very, very uplifting. The Libyan people in these elections and also in electing people and managing their own municipalities and towns and neighborhoods was the good story. But Libya then became a body without a head or a body with three conflicting heads. And the only way to make sense of it is to focus on the militarization of this uprising and also the fact that the faction that did not succeed in the election, did not win the elections, mainly some hardcore militias, extreme groups that don't believe even in the democratic process, aided by regional powers with the participation of the European Union, and the failure of the Obama administration to rein on its regional allies, the Libyan people were overwhelmed, and the counter-revolution took over. And we could say, in summary, the uprising was militarized, and also we could say that the leaders of the transition bear some responsibility. Libya is not a failed state. Libya had a failed transition.
So tell us more about these particular factions and who are the regional players that pulled your country into different directions.
Right now, there are three governments. There is, and if we take ISIS or ISIL in Libya, we could say that there are four governments. In eastern Libya, there is the parliament and the government that represent the parliament in the city of Al-Bayda, supported by General Haftar, Khalifa Haftar, who is formed this kind of army based on the old officers and soldiers from the Libyan National Army, who is fighting the extremist groups in Derna, Benghazi, and also in Nijdabia. And because of the chaos in Benghazi, he gained tremendous support. But he's a very, very polarizing figure, nevertheless. So this is the government in eastern Libya. In western Libya, there are two governments. There is the government of the old National General Congress, which was elected in 2012, but also was replaced by the new parliament in eastern Libya. However, the Islamists who controlled that organization had refused to accept the results, and militias allied with them called Libya Dawn, mainly from Misrata and other groups. They took over the airport and the city. So there is a government led by the old organization, and the head of that government is called a man by the name of Khalifa Rouail. And in 2015, if you recall, in Skhirat in Morocco, the UN engineered and led a negotiation between the different factions, and they tried to find some consensus or some modus vivendi between these groups. And out of it, Mr. Leon, the Spaniard, who was the representative of the UN in Libya, declared a compromise called the Skhirat Agreement. And out of this, they declared a new government, the Libyan Agreement, the Accord Agreement government, or what's called the Libyan Consensus Government, that's now also in Tripoli, but stationed in a naval base near Tripoli. And the head of that government is Mr. Faiz al-Sarraj. So what you have is literally three governments, one in eastern Libya, two in western Libya, and ISIL or ISIL in the city of Sirte in central Libya. That's the hometown of the late Colonel Gaddafi.
So we'll come back to ISIL, but for now, tell us about these two governments in the West. One of them is supported by the so-called international community.
Correct.
Tell us, what's the contrast there between the two?
The Mr. Whale government is supported by Islamist groups who, if you recall, they really didn't do well in the three Libyan elections. But they are financed by some regional governments, especially Qatar and Turkey, and also Sudan earlier.
Sudan now is financing, okay.
Yeah, well, they have a lot of arms, and also I think they also are probably the exit to export Qatari and also Turkish aid. So there is that. And there's a big rivalry between the current government in Khartoum and the late Colonel Gaddafi, and they fought each other through proxy, supporting each of the opposition groups, either in South Sudan or in Darfur or in the Libyan opposition against the old regime. So there is that. And also the fact that many Libyan Afghani fighters, Mujahideen, came from Afghanistan, hardcore Al-Qaeda, with a Wahhabi and also Salafi new view of society, and hardened by their experience in Afghanistan and also in other parts of the Middle East, they came back to Libya and led by a figure earlier by the name of, you know, Abdul Hakim Abu al-Haj, who was really pushed by the Qatari government very much to be a major figure. And now he's a very, very wealthy businessman. But his party and his also his candidacy for the parliament did not succeed, and he is now a very successful man. But also there are other groups that are associated with the jihadi and Salafi movement, and their godfather is the Mufti of Libya called Sheikh Sadiq al-Ghariani. So these groups are small, but because they are militarily very, very well organized and armed, they really are intimidating and also imposing their will in Tripoli and other groups. So in other words, the groups, even though they are small, but they are armed and they can really impose their will on the people. Just keep in mind, Khalil, in 2011, the armed groups, the revolutionary groups, armed Kataib.
Phalanges.
Yes. They were around between 25 to 30,000 fighters. By 2014, they really, the number inflated, and they began to get salaries from all of those governments, transitional governments. And the number was very, you would be shocked to know that they were over some estimate 200,000. And here you're talking about young men who have limited education, and suddenly they have guns, prestige, and salaries. So there is a political economy of the militarization where these groups refused to support the transitional plan, and they became really entrenched. And the most interesting thing about this unintended consequences in Libya, two things. The rise of these militarized groups and the emergence of the city of Misrata as a very, very major power in western Libya. So in other words, that the lack of a clear vision what to do after the revolution, the foolish idea of trying to destroy the older, not to recall the army and the police and all other institutions, and try to, through the exclusion law, to punish all of the people who serve in the old regime as in Iraq, and all of that contributed to a situation, or if you say, maybe, if you like, if you might, you might say it's a vacuum.
Yes.
And who filled the vacuum? The militarized groups, the militias, and the hardened, you know, mujahideen from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and also Syria. So you have a really unintended consequences to an uprising that was peaceful and very, very democratic.
And secular, and largely secular. It wasn't captured.
No, it was not. It was not. Mm. And that ideology and vision of Islam is very alien to Libyan people. And I was not surprised that they didn't do well in the elections. However, the role of the Gulf money, especially the Qatari money, and the very, very, unfortunately, destructive role of Erdogan in Turkey and his foreign policy all helped creating and supporting these groups against the wills of the majority of the public opinion in Libya. The result is really a counter-revolution, an stalled transition, and de facto civil war.
So you've described this side of it, this one power center, if we can call it that. How about the other side? You said there are two governments now in Tripoli.
The government that's now marginalized, but also the hardcore Islamist and the Mufti of Libya, who is not very well liked in many parts of Libya because he's pushing for a jihad against his rivals. This government is trying to cling to power, and the only reason it's still surviving, there are some militias, especially Islamist and jihadist militias, are behind it. The international community support for the Skhirat Agreement in 2015 kind of marginalized it a little bit. But because there was no unified Libyan government, they still try to make some noise and mobilize their groups. And the Libyan people, because now there is no police, there is no national army, there is no security, and even the banks now have no liquidity in many, many ways. So people are not getting salaries. And there is kidnapping, there is also shooting. I have even family and friends stories that are horrific about the lack of stability and order and law in Libyan cities. And at the same time, there are some towns and regions inside Libya that had no fighting, and people in a creative way, they are managing their own affairs, which is very, very fascinating.
So in the West, the Tripoli, you have these Islamist factions that are supported by regional forces like Turkey.
Yes, by Islamic, by basically militias that support them, even though they are not very, very much liked.
And what happened to the elected government?
Well, the parliament could not meet in Tripoli, and Benghazi was a war zone in 2013. So the city of Tobruk said, come, we'll be happy to give you, protect you and give you a place to work. So the government...
The city is in the east.
The farthest right. End of eastern Libya,
right.
The city of Tobruk.
Right.
And so the parliament was refused there and began to work there with tremendous difficulties because some representatives could not travel from western Libya or southern Libya to Tobruk, and they have to go through a lot of hassle to get there. And the government that was formed by the parliament took place and began to operate in the city of Baida, which is in the heart of the Green Mountain. It's a very, very beautiful city. It used to be one of the capitals of Libya under the monarchy. Benghazi was a war zone between General Haftar and what remained of the army, the Libyan army, and the Ansar Sharia and the hardcore jihadist and extreme Islamist groups supported by Misrata and the groups in Tripoli as allies. And the city of Derna was also controlled by them. The army, for 2 years since General Haftar declared himself to be the leader of the Libyan army and he's trying to rebuild the Libyan army, he was a polarizing figure. But when he made some success in fighting them in Benghazi, and when really the killing and the turmoil and the assassination of over 500 civil activists and lawyers and engineers and journalists, then General Haftar became looked at as a really acceptable figure. Benghazi now almost kind of liberated. And just recently, a couple of weeks ago, the army took over the four main oil ports in the Gulf of Sirte.
So Haftar has managed to have some results.
The guy with a very, very controversial history, including a failed war in Chad, working for an organization that was sponsored and protected by the CIA, and then resurrected his career after this really disgrace defeat in Chad in the 80s. And because people became so desperate for stability and for fighting lawlessness, and also the one who want to declare them an Islamic and assassinate civic activists, all of that in a time of desperation, when General Haftar and the remainder of the army began to fight these jihadists and have some success by the end of 2015 and definitely by expanding west, people began to really tell me that, well, either save Benghazi and the other cities, or Benghazi would become like Sirte under the control of the likes of the ISIL or ISIS in a very draconian, very, very violent and intolerant organization that alien to us. So I think we could say that the dire situation in eastern Libya and the success of the army under General Haftar made him almost kind of an accepted figure in the Libyan civil war.
So it looks as if Libya is also grappling with these unpalatable choices between going back to dictator, a strongman like Haftar, who used to be part of Gaddafi's military,
yes,
and just chaos.
That's we should look at what's going on in Libya, Khalil, if we want to reflect about what are the patterns and what was missing and why things went bad as they did in Libya. Then we have to look at Libya and other places together. There is, of course, a variety of specific conditions in each country. But let me suggest some ideas about how to make sense of this really an unfortunate unraveling of the situation to violence and instability and civil war and militarization. I think we have to say that Libya and the other also Arab Spring countries, we should look at the situation and be critical even of the leadership. The leadership of this uprising was naive and was spontaneous in many ways, but did not think of what's going to happen afterwards. The idea was we want democracy, we want the rule of law, but also there was no organization, there is no vision to deal with the consequences of the counter-revolution, and also what would be the alternative to these dictatorships. So that was a major failure in the leadership. And I used to think that leadership doesn't matter because we're sick of the great leaders, sick of charismatic ones, and so for a long time. And we had one after another in most of the 20th century. But I was wrong, Khalil. I think able, humane, uncorrupted leaders who are willing to serve others and bring good people, that's actually it was a missing component of these uprisings. The other thing is also we cannot look at these societies from inside alone as isolated islands, including Libya. I think we have to understand the role of the Gulf states who took, you know, the opportunity, and they are not very democratic, by the way. We know that. They were not say that they would support this uprising. They want to get rid of their rivals. They want to get rid of Saddam Hussein. They want to get rid of the Assad family. They want to get rid of Gaddafi, who was a thorn in their side. So they had their own motive to get rid of these dictatorships, but not necessarily in an alliance or in a consistent way to accept people's choices. And they themselves are very, very much undemocratic, very hierarchical, very, very full of corruption and also severe inequalities, and therefore they took this opportunity to really settle score with the regimes, not to support the aspiration of the public opinion and the ordinary people in these countries, including in Libya. This is, I think, important. And the third component, I have to say, even though President Obama, for example, admitted that was the worst, said that, you know, this is the worst decision, not to be aware of what happened in Libya. That's good to know. However, the truth of the matter, the United States and the European Union toppled a regime and then let the Libyan people really a victim of regional powers, extremist jihadist groups, and also they were quiet when Qatar and Turkey and other groups and the jihadists who were and the ISIL or ISIS fighters coming to Libya, and they didn't do anything about it. So I think the public opinion in Libya is very, very angry and disappointed, rightly disappointed about the fact that this regional counter-movement and support led to not only steal these uprising, it's actually imposed a counter-revolution.
Haftar seems to draw inspiration and support from the neighbor to the east, Egypt, which has, under General Sisi, devolved into a dictatorship even worse than that of Mubarak before him. Are dictatorship and tyranny the only alternative to chaos and anarchy? That's what the European colonialists in North Africa used to say, that there's nothing there. And Qaddafi himself used that same argument, saying, look, you think I'm bad, you should see after me how bad it could become.
Yeah,
we have Islamists, yeah. We have all sorts of problems. Of course, he contributed to that himself. He made sure of that himself, as Assad is also in Syria and all these dictators.
That's the irony. I think, as of course, the colonialists used to say these things, and they still look at the region now, before the formation of the national, these independent nationalist societies. They want to still look at the region through the lenses of the colonial perspective, which is a region full of sects, tribes, ethnic groups, as if there is no societies that existed for almost 70, 80, 90 years with national consciousness and middle classes. And yes, diversity too, but almost as they want to go to back to the colonial lenses and the stability argument, which is very at heart, very, very racist and condescending and patronizing. And unfortunately, at the same time, they try to even talk about, in the most arrogant language, that maybe the societies have to be divided into small states and a different region because they are artificial anyway. So that kind of talk is not really new. And somebody who studied the colonial history of North Africa and the Sahara for 30 years, it doesn't sound new to me. Very arrogant. And it doesn't really allow people to talk for themselves, try to see through the crisis some way of justifying old anxieties and old designs. In Egypt, the model you mentioned, Khalil, I think it's very, very obvious that General Sisi in Egypt so in supports General Haftar in Libya, and is very nervous about the borders and the Islamists and the Muslim Brothers who took refuge in Libya and other places. So it's very natural that they support General Haftar, and General Haftar probably see himself through the model of Sisi as a savior, or self-perception of himself as a savior of the country. What's important now is how to stop the killing, how to stop the civil war. I don't think General Haftar should be demonized or the other group should be demonized. The point now to stop the killing, and General Haftar has, if he is really cares about the views and the interests of the Libyan people, he has to say, I have no interest in power. I'm just serving this to help bring stability to what goes on. And in the civil war, whether that's really going to happen or not, I don't know. But I know for now what matters is to stop the killing, stop the civil war, because people are really suffering. I mean, you will not believe it. Even now, food and medicine are really a tough chore in Libya, because at least in the last 3-4 years, most families in Libya, east-west, despite the fighting, they still received their salaries. Maybe 2 months late, 3 months late, 4 months late, but they had their salaries and they had their accounts in the banks. Right now, salaries haven't been paid for at least 5-6 months sometimes. And even folks who have accounts in the banks, they couldn't write checks, they couldn't get money from their own accounts, and that's going to create a horrendous human tragedy in the country. I think the situation in Libya might deteriorate a little bit more than we think. And everybody's watching and saying, oh, Libyans have to agree and so on. So without stopping the role of the outside forces and the support of the regional powers, including allies in the United States, it would be wishful thinking to assume that the civil war is going to stop in its own. And the people can't do much because people don't have guns, they don't have arms, and Libya is awash with guns, but in the hands of the wrong groups.
So you mentioned that Haftar at some point seemed to be close to the CIA. What is his relationship right now with the West, this consensus they're trying to build behind a national government?
Well, that's where you would have really ambiguous declarations, but also secret operations. In public, the European Union and the United States supports the Faisal-Sarraj government. And before that, they supported the parliament, but they are trying to find a way for the parliament to give its own vote, its approval of this national security government formed in Morocco in last year. But on the ground, you will find military advisors and arms supporting General Haftar's army.
You mean Western military?
Yes, talking about France, you're talking about the United States, you're talking about also supporting, and even three French soldiers were killed, I think, earlier this year, actually, as far maybe a month ago. And in eastern Libya, the city of Misrata, which is the third largest city, and the one who really by accident, due to its siege and the fact it has port, got all the arms and the support. So its armed militia became the most powerful in western Libya. And we know that American aid and English and Italian advisors have been supporting and advising the armed groups in Misrata, and the fight against ISIS in Sirte was very much aided by these military advisors and also the drones attacks and even the military attacks against ISIS in Sirte. So what you have in public, they support the National Accord Agreement government by Faisal Sarraj, and they're trying to convince the parliament members in eastern Libya and Tobruk to have all the members together. Now it's split, so they could approve the government. So far, they haven't approved it, and they rejected it. So they're trying to find, in terms of public announcement and meetings in Europe and also in Cairo and Tunis and so, some way to confirm that. But on the ground, you find them supporting both forces, the forces in eastern Libya and the forces in western Libya. Besides the French, I think it's no secret that they still use the ethnic or the minority factor in southern Libya, which is not more than a 3% or a 5% of the whole country, with an eye on reviving their own colonial influence in Fezzan, which is the southern region of Libya, which they controlled shortly between 1943 and 1951.
So what does this ethnic factor tell us?
Well, Libya is really a homogenous country. Of all the North African countries, it's the most homogenous. It really had small minority of Amazigh, in Berber. Western Libya, in Berber. The Jebel, and also Zuara.
Right.
And it had small groups of Libyan Tuareg and Tibu.
Who are also Berbers, also Amazigh, the Tuareg.
They are, but they are Amazigh, but they also are different from the other ones in the sense that they have different dialects, but also they lived mostly in southern Libya. So what they try to focus on is to advocate the idea of the languages and the minority and the discrimination. I think this is with a very, very much an eye on the changes in the Libyan border that are very open. So what you have is instead of a small Libyan Tibu population, for example, the town of southern Libya and southeastern Libya, but you have almost 1 million in northern Chad, many of them armed and are fighting against the central government in Chad since independence in the 1960s. Many of them are now moved to arms groups, moved to southern Libya and central Libya. So Libyan borders are really an open frontiers, not to mention the thousands and thousands of immigrants who want to reach Europe. So the Libyan situation has really turned upside down. Libya is now in a very, very major crisis in the lack of a central agreed government, making things continue even more.
There's a power vacuum that has invited almost the ISIS type of forces to come in because there's this vacuum and also the immigration. So the French and the Italians are directly concerned beyond being the former colonial powers. They're also directly concerned about the problem of ISIS, which is exploding in Europe in major ways.
Yes.
And they're also concerned about the immigration.
Yes,
which
that's
also out of control.
Absolutely right. And Libya is the soft or the weakest link as far as the flow because Libya has a huge immigrants, big frontiers. Libya is now, after the split of Sudan to Sudan and South Sudan, is the third largest country after Algeria, the Congo, is Libya now. And it has a long, long Mediterranean coast. So with the disintegration of the Libyan army, and the patrols of the Libyan southern frontiers and Libyan coast, it's no wonder that thousand, if not also almost a million or so, are coming through Libya. And the smugglers are having a feast. These are African, North African, and also European smugglers are making so much money exploiting those poor immigrants who are trying to get to Europe. So you're correct, Khalid. I think the Europeans are very also concerned about this major human flaw of immigrants.
So they have at least three major, or maybe they're all related, three major goals. Number one, to try to help shore up some kind of national government in Libya.
Yes.
The ISIS problem, definitely nobody's interested in having ISIS too close to them.
Yes.
And Libya is at the door of Europe. ISIS is there. It doesn't help France, Belgium, etc. And the problem of this immigration that's out of control. I remember Gaddafi vividly. I remember him when things started moving in Libya. He said, oh, he was mocking the Europeans, said, you want a flood of African, which was racist on his part, but he was saying, you know, the Africans are going to flood Europe if I'm gone.
Absolutely. I think he used it as a tool, as a weapon to negotiate with the Europeans. I think he really maliciously used this human tragedy for his own ends, no question about it. The other factor also, I think we have to say it was a dictatorship, definitely. There is no question about it. That's why it became dated and was out of reach, and people revolted against it, you know, despite the fact that at the beginning they just wanted reform to work its own course. The many Europeans, they really disliked him for all kind of reasons, and they could not penetrate his regime, and he had a security apparatus that was very, very tough to penetrate. And right now, everything is open, and I think the Europeans, and even I would claim the Obama administration, had no vision what to do with the chaos and instability that they helped create. And in a way, they just want to say, we want to stop this because this is really important to our security, but they are not willing to have a consistent policy, consistent vision to help elected officials negotiate a transition that will help not only the Libyan people, but also on the long term, create a stable Libya that's important to everybody. On the other hand, or equally important, if Libya continues to disintegrate and unravel, I think it's not only North Africa will suffer. I think Europe will be facing huge calamities that are unprecedented since World War II.
The Algerians and Tunisians have been trying to collaborate to try to protect their borders. The Egyptians are also worried about the Sahel region south of Libya also has suffered from this open supermarket of weapons. What have happened to the million of or so of Libyans who fled to Tunisia in the early days? Are they still there, or some of them coming back to Libya?
Some of them, they go back and forth. Most of the middle classes and the upper middle class who could still have savings, they went there. But people who are struggling and have no savings, their savings dwindled. I understand now there is a tremendous human cost for families who have no money. And Tunisia is a small country but has more, double the size of the Libyan population. And it's not going to be easy with high unemployment rate in Tunis and in Egypt. So you're talking about really people struggling in very, very much an old side. Some will go back to Libya, get more money and come back. Some went back to Libya. But all in all, they're facing a really major social and human crisis that are not used to. And they are frustrated because they feel like, you know, we come from a wealthy country. We deserve this and this. And I think that brings, unfortunately, the point that you mentioned earlier, Khalid, people are, which is ironic, because that was not the solution. They are still now lamenting the stability under the dictatorship of Gaddafi.
We mentioned several times that ISIS or ISIL, Daesh,
is
maybe closer to the Arabic, which started in Iraq and in Syria. Now they found a power vacuum in Libya. They managed to root themselves in there. Tell us a little bit about who are these people. Are they actually people from Syria and Iraq? Or are they just local Libyans who claim that mantle of ISIL and in their name are trying to create their own caliphate? Who are they and what is their current situation now they're coming to direct attack?
Well, what we know so far is that they are international movement. Mm. So some are Yemenis, some are Iraqis, some are Syrians. And yes, there are some Libyans. Remember that North Africans fought with Iraq before, and they fought with ISIS and in Syria. As a matter of fact, the vast majority of the ISIS fighters, they come from Tunisia. So we know for now, we don't have a conclusive number, but we know that many of them are from Tunisia, many are from Yemen, and even from African countries, like Muslim countries like Chad, and also from Nigeria, and from among the immigrants there too. And the leaders, they are Tunisians and Iraqis who are sent by the Raqqa, capital of the Daesh in Syria, and only maybe one-third of them or one-quarter of them is Libyan, because most of them now, especially in the fight in Sirte, we know more and more that most of them are international Muslim fighters who come from neighboring countries and also from other countries. So their brand of Islam was very scary. They were brutal and efficient, yet also they imposed beheading and whipping, and also very much an alien form of Islam to the Maliki North African Islam.
Mm-hmm. So now that they're under attack, are they, in your opinion, going to disappear? And what would the implications be? Does that help the solution?
Well, I think in the short term, the General Haftar and the Masrata forces have to sit in the table, and I think the compromise there will end the civil war. Whether that happened or not, I don't know. I think at least that would be the only way to stop the war. But I think Libya and the UN and the United States and the European Union should be pressured to really help the Libyan government. Is that Faisal Sarraj's government? I don't know. It's now, it looks like it's still very marginal. But the plan was to have an election after seizing all of the military activities in a year. And at this time, the UN should come in a full force and try to protect and have a plan for the armed young men, promise them some exit or some plan for their employment and no retribution for turning down and giving up their arms. And I think the election hopefully should protect that kind of civic vision. And I hope that there will be, now there seems to be some dialogue among civic activists, intellectuals and professionals about what went wrong and how could we really bring things together. If the war, civil war, will start by this compromise and then there would be approval of the government, an election within a year, then I think the next challenge would be Libya needs no more election, maybe period of one or two until the country will have some stability. And I would like to revive the call I made in Tripoli in 2011 when they invited me to come and participate in a conference, is that I think Libya, more than any other neighboring country, needs, besides self-criticism and assessment of what went wrong, is maybe a commission for truth and reconciliation that will try to build on the compromise in 1951 when Libya became independent due to the fact that the groups who were fighting each other, they agreed on at least some compromise to create a state. I think that's still, to me, important. Before you do that, though, Khalil, I would say a commission has to go around the country for maybe 3-4 months, meet with people and with communities and municipalities and also and get their inputs and build a commission that's really a Libyan one. It's the problem for Libya, and for that matter, for all the Arab societies now are facing really the most horrible civil wars and divisions and conflict, is really for civic activists and intellectuals and professional groups, is to begin to say, let's sit down and learn from the mistakes. What happened in the region is not really unique. We know in most societies after uprising and revolutions, it sometimes takes a decade to really build things. But also whether that's not going to happen spontaneously or automatically, I think there has to be an attempt to learn, attempt to focus on what really unified people, not what divide them. And that needs social activism, intellectual self-reflections, and maybe learning from the mistakes that happened in the last 5 years. I think that's to be a good start. And then I think after that, things might go back to the right direction. Right now, we can see only, doom and gloom.
Yes, but Algeria went through something a little bit similar about 20 years ago when Bouteflika did offer some measure of legitimacy and protection for people who had fought the government. We're seeing something similar in Colombia right now as we speak.
Exactly. This is what I have in mind, Khalid. I think you're right on the money. What happened in Algeria was bloody, and we know that at least 100,000 people were killed, and some people said 200,000. Mm-hmm. And I would say this happened all the time, and nobody has a monopoly for violence or being vicious or civil wars. This happened in the West, happened in the East, and happened now in the region. And I think, unfortunately, we can't change the past. What we could do is we could learn from the past and learn from other experiences and what happened in Algeria, what's going on in Colombia now, and what happened in other societies that tried to really find an exit from or revival from the ashes. I think this is, to me, is where the energies and the goodwill of people who really want to put off the fire, think about pulling people together, reconcile differences, and heal the wounds, and that's the only way you could do it. Other than that, the killing and the structure of violence and the economy in that produced this really vicious conflict might continue for years, and we know societies can probably sometimes, unless they resolve the roots of these conflicts and civil wars, they might rage for longer years.
Ali Ahmida is chair of the Political Science Department at University of New England and author of The Making of Modern Libya. He spoke with Khalil Bendi. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, I'm Mira Nablusi. We're talking today to Hussein Khalili, co-founder of the Symbiosis Art Festival, which took place in Lesbos, Greece, between July 26 and August 26. Symbiosis aims to build capacity in the community and promote cross-cultural collaborations between the local community in the island of Lesbos and the refugee population and international activists and volunteers. Hussein Khalili is an activist born and raised in Nablus, Palestine, and now lives in Stockholm, Sweden. He was a co-founder of several organizations, such as the Palestinian Youth Democratic Platform in Nablus, Palestine, 1994, the Palestinian Youth Network, now known as the Palestinian Youth Movement, in 2006, the Ship to Gaza in 2008, and also was board member during the Freedom Flotilla to Gaza in 2010, and finally, the Hope Theater and Symbiosis Lesbos Art Festival in 2016. Hussein Khalili has also contributed to a few books, like Peace Under Fire, published by Verso in 2004, and Arab publications like Al Tahrir newspaper and Zaid 18 or Plus 18 online magazine. Welcome, Hussein.
Hi, Mira.
You first arrived in Lesbos, which many of us have heard of as the hotspot of the refugee population stuck in Greece, in January of this year to work as a culture mediator for Doctors Without Borders. And then with four other Greek activists, you came up with the idea of the Symbiosis Art Festival. Tell us about the festival and where did the idea come from?
Actually, the idea came from the beginning when I arrived there. My concern was working with the refugees. I was working with the search and rescue, so I was most of the time out in the sea. But afterwards, start to meet the local population of Lesbos or the village where I lived called Molivos. And there start to see there's another actually side to the story. Not only the refugees, there's as well the local community with facing huge difficulties in relation to, first of all, the economic crisis in Greece and as well because of the refugee crisis, which has been reason why a lot of charter company organizers actually stop sending tourists to the island and cancel their bookings. And that actually affects the community badly. That time we start thinking about creating something that we can put refugees, local population together, try to see the opportunity rather than the obstacles from refugees arriving, providing platform where people can come together, create new things, create this new community. So that was the idea at the beginning. I met other activists, local from the island, who were thinking as well of ideas like that. So we came together and we met another person who was in London and as well planning to do something. We joined together and we come with the idea of the festival, Symbiosis. The Hope Theatre was a kind of umbrella with the Symbiosis Art Festival. It's an idea about providing workshop and art and refugee camps, bringing together local of the island refugees and international, trying to as well fill out the island differently, give another aspect of the situation there. See the opportunities that created through this interaction between refugees, internationals, and the local community in the island. It took a lot of time to organize, and with lack of money and support, we did that almost for nothing. We get like only some support from local organizations and local businesses. At the end, we managed to have a lot of artists from different places joined us in the island from Europe, Middle East. Yeah, even we have a band that came all the way from Senegal and were with us there. So that was like the first step, actually. We got a lot of really positive reaction from the population there. We managed to create a lot of things in the refugee camps. A lot of projects started as well during the festival and partnership with different local initiatives and as well international who work on the island. Now we are planning for our next step, which related mostly to the Hope Bus and the caravan.
Tell us a little bit more about the local community and the refugees and the relationship between them, and how did they receive the event? What did it look like? Did you have people coming from both communities together? What was your focus? I saw images of children on your Facebook page in workshops and stuff like that. Tell us a little bit more about that.
The workshop took place actually in refugee camps. We divided the event into three different locations, main different locations, and as well a lot of activities happened in refugee camps. The event I attended was really great. Locals were there, and that was very, very important for us because during this period, since the crisis started, a lot of the fascist group in the island started to try actually to recruit and work like in propaganda against refugees. And we felt we actually succeeded in reaching a lot of people who joined us. And especially with the last day with the carnival, we had in cooperation with a culture center called Mosaic, bringing together local and refugees to work together in different things. So refugees teaching Arabic, local teaching Greek, so a lot of other activities together. So we had this carnival at the end, started from their center in Mytilene and ended back in their center after we toured the whole town and came back. That was a very colorful, beautiful presentation of the idea, and actually present the idea very well when local refugees and international were together marching with material made together out of recycling, actually, some rubbish, and create something new, very beautiful. That was really, really beautiful and strong.
In relation to interaction between the local community and with the refugee population, since you've been there now a few times, you were starting to talk about a right-wing group in the area that was trying to recruit people. Tell us a little bit about how you saw things when you first arrived in the island and how you see things right now.
First of all, like, I was amazed actually by the reaction of the locals. People were helping out. They were fishermen, were out on the water helping refugees even before the NGOs arrived to the island. People were doing that themselves, up in their homes. There was a lot of solidarity, actually, from the local population. In a small, specific village called Skala Skamia, very, very small village on the north side of the island. It's like one of the areas where most of the refugees arrived. This place, I saw a lot of amazing stuff. Like once, the mayor of the village refused to let the refugees leave the village to Moria. The one just insisted to have them staying that night at the village and had like a party and cooked together and were like separating together. That was amazing. In one case, when we lost people, that was a very, very sad day for everyone. But the reaction of the people was really amazing. They were very, very generous. And we're talking about a very poor village. Mm-hmm. But those people, actually, they were refugees from 1920, 1924 war between Turkey and Greece. So they were open and they were like sharing, again, their own stories as well, refugees. Mostly that was the attitude of the people on Lesbos. But some places we faced as well, people who were concerned about the future, since the island depends on tourism as the main source of income. We tried to help actually those people to see the opportunity of having refugees instead of looking at the obstacle that, or what happened with the charter tourism. And that was as well one of the reasons of like focusing on the culture of the island, trying to reintroduce the place, because this place wasn't really, before the 50s, wasn't famous for tourism. And the tourism there started as a culture of tourism, and that's attracted different kind of tourism that the charter tour organizer bring to the island. So we tried actually to think about it this way, to try to provide the alternative to this kind of tourism, and that was to support the voices that stand in solidarity with refugees. Last week, the same day that Moria refugee camp was set on fire, a demonstration in Mytilene took place against refugees. But according to a lot of sources there, there's a lot of people came actually from the mainland and as well from some places around the island to join. And there was like 200 people in this demonstration.
200 people against the refugees.
Refugees, exactly. Okay. So that was one case. But I really trust the people of this place. I saw how they are. I lived there almost 8 months. I know this is the example that Lesbos can give to the world. This can be an example that can be followed by other places, and we as people involved in helping refugees and supporting refugees on Lesbos, we have actually responsibility toward the people there. We can't let Lesbos go down, because if Lesbos go down, then that will be an example for others to block their doors. They close their doors in front of refugees. So we need to support the people there and to come with different ideas how to support them. And we have now, we have an organization started here in Sweden based on an organization, old organization, work with culture and integration, and work a lot with the Roma population, different places in the Balkan area, and as well with the integration with the Roma in the north, northern Europe. So we now try to as well come with ideas as well, like with community banking and different kind of solidarity ideas, which focus on supporting economical independence for different communities and try to help them find out different ways mm-hmm. of surviving. We focus not only on Greece, because that's when we are moving to different places. We have partners in Italy, Serbia, Turkey, and of course Greece and Germany.
Hossein Khalili is co-founder of the Symbiosis Art Festival, which took place in Lesbos, Greece between July 26 and August 26. The festival promotes cross-cultural collaborations between the local community in the island of Lesbos, the refugee population, and international activists and volunteers. He spoke with Vomina's Mira Nabulsi. Next week, in the second part of the interview, Hossein will talk about the plight of refugees in the Greek island of Lesbos. From Pacifica Radio, this is Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
That's it for us this week. Voices of the Middle East and North Africa is produced at KPFA Studios in Berkeley.
To get in touch, you can call us at 510-848-6767, extension 632. Email vomekpfa@yahoo.com. Connect with us on our Facebook at Voices of the Middle East and North Africa, or follow us on Vomina Radio. Please join us next time for another edition of Voices of the Middle East and North Africa.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Sea Shepherd, Ocean Protectors, Captain Paul Watson.
Nous avons des questions à vous poser concernant votre activité. Qu'est-ce que vous pouvez nous en dire?
I established the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society in 1977 as an organization to intervene against poaching, against illegal activities on the high seas. So we're really an anti-poaching organization. And we intervene globally, and we do so with what I call aggressive nonviolence.
What is aggressive nonviolence?
Well, we're aggressive, but we never injure anybody. And in our entire 40-year experience, we've never caused a single injury to any person at all. But we have shut down numerous poaching operations from, you know, overfishing, whaling, shark killing, turtle killing. We've shut these things down through aggressive intervention, but at the same time being very careful not to injure anybody.
How do you imagine the ocean's future? From your point of view, will it be better or, on the contrary, worse?
Well, the future of the ocean is what we're seeing right now, which is an escalating diminishment of biodiversity. We've lost 90% of the fishes over the last 100 years. We've had a 40% diminishment in phytoplankton population since 1950. So there's some very serious situations that have been happening as far as a diminishment of biodiversity. The problem is most people are unaware of that. By 2048, according to Dr. Boris Worm of Dalhousie University and Dr. Daniel Pauly of the University of British Columbia, who are the two foremost oceanographic fishery scientists, there won't be any fishing industry in 2048 because there won't be any fish. There won't be any coral reefs. So what we're looking at is an ecological disaster within our oceans, and that doesn't bode well for the future of humanity because, as I always say, if the ocean dies, we die. We don't live on this planet with a dead ocean, and as the ocean is diminished, our ability to survive is diminished.
That was a clip from one of the last interviews Captain Paul Watson gave in France in June 2016. He's now free to travel again after living in exile in Paris for 2 years under the protection of the French government. He was wanted by Costa Rica. There he was accused of intervening to stop a Costa Rican ship that was illegally finning sharks in Guatemalan waters. And Japan asked for his arrest on conspiracy charges stemming from a Sea Shepherd campaign to stop Japan's illegal whaling in the Southern Ocean. Today, Paul Watson has his dual citizen passports back from the U.S. and from Canada. Paul Watson was co-founder of Greenpeace and led the campaign against the slaughter of baby seals in the late 70s. When Patrick Moore became president of Greenpeace Canada, he halted direct action and forced Watson out. Today, Patrick Moore is a spokesperson for Monsanto and the nuclear industry. Paul Watson never stopped his involvement in direct action. After his ouster from Greenpeace, he founded the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. It's an international, non-profit, marine wildlife conservation organization. Their mission is to end the destruction of habitat and the slaughter of wildlife in the world's oceans. Paul Watson is both praised and criticized for Sea Shepherd's practice of aggressive nonviolence. Watson says that some laws and conventions exist to protect the oceans and their inhabitants. However, these laws are very rarely enforced. He and his legal team make the case that non-governmental private organizations, such as Sea Shepherd, have the right to enforce international conservation laws in neutral waters. Sea Shepherd's crews have arrested poachers, removed illegal fishing nets, and chased vessels back into their home ports. They document their actions and collect and preserve evidence, turning that material over to authorities for prosecution. There are now many examples of Sea Shepherd assisting small nations that have no navy or coast guard to confront the international vessels that plunder their territorial waters. Of course, not all governments accept the enforcement power of Sea Shepherd, as is the case with Japan and Costa Rica. At the end of August 2016, Sea Shepherd launched the Ocean Warrior, the first ship fast enough to outrun the Japanese whaling fleet. Here are excerpts from a wide-ranging interview done in France in June 2016. You can see the whole hour on YouTube on the channel Climate State. The two French interviewers did not identify themselves, but their organization is ThinkerView.
Despite your fight, humanity does not measure the impact of losing biodiversity in oceans. So concretely, when are things going to change and how could it change?
For millions of years, the ocean has been the life support system of the planet. If you look at the Earth as a spaceship, which is traveling through space, which is what it is, every spaceship has a life support system. And it provides the food we eat, it regulates the temperature, controls the climate, and it provides the air that we breathe. And that life support system is to be found in the ocean. And that life support system is run by a crew, which are all these various species that make it work. We're not crew, we're passengers. We're having a great time entertaining ourselves. But what we're doing is killing off the crew, the phytoplankton that produces the oxygen, the whales that provide the nutrients for the phytoplankton, the interrelationship with all the species that keeps everything running and has kept everything running for millions of years. We're seriously compromising the efficiency of that life support system. And that's a very serious situation. 40% diminishment in phytoplankton population since 1950 is a serious situation that really nobody's aware of. Phytoplankton provides between 50 and 70 or possibly even 80% of all of the oxygen that we breathe, the rest coming from trees and plants. And if you remove phytoplankton, which is now seriously being depleted, then we simply will not have oxygen to breathe. And the relationship between phytoplankton and whales is that whales provide the nutrients for the phytoplankton, iron and nitrogen primarily, through the feces, similar to horse manure on providing fertilizer on a farm. So the whales are, in fact, a, the farmers of the ocean. But we don't, you know, we're not intelligent enough to really understand all of those interrelationships and the interdependence of all of those species. And as such, we're depleting that ability of the oceanic ecosystems to sustain life on this planet.
I'm sure you heard about the COP21, the Conference of Parties in Paris. Now, we're 6 months later. What is your feeling about these agreements? And do you think the conference pushed people and companies to realize the emergency of the situation?
Well, COP21 was a nothing event. Nothing came out of it. It was a great opportunity for all the world leaders to pat themselves on the back and do photo opportunities about how they're going to save the planet, but they didn't discuss anything of any relevance. I presented a booklet on solutions to climate change that nobody wants to hear, and they certainly didn't want to hear it, and they certainly didn't discuss it. And the fact is that if we want to protect this planet from the consequences of climate change, and one, we have to allow the ocean to repair itself. That means we have to stop all industrialized fishing operations. We have to stop subsidies on industrialized fishing operations. And unless we're willing to do that, the oceans are going to die. Another solution to that is that we have to switch to plant-based diets because we're killing 65 billion animals every year, and that's not counting the ones that we take out of the ocean. And the animal husbandry industry contributes more greenhouse gases to the atmosphere than the entire transportation industry, and also consumes more water, creates dead zones, and is one of the most serious causes of pollution, both in groundwater and in the ocean. But nobody really wants to address those solutions. They want to find answers that are, you know, that are acceptable, that don't affect our lifestyle. And at the same time, governments want to find solutions through taxation. They figure that this is a good opportunity to tax everybody in order to bring that money. But as I found on environmental taxes throughout the world, is that when they're collected, they don't go towards solving the problem. They basically go to what governments usually spend their money on, which is wasting it on ridiculous things like defense or subsidies or their own payrolls.
Is France involved on green issues or completely blind?
Well, France is no different than any other country, which means that France, like all these other countries, is doing nothing to address the real problems. But just on the oceans, for example, France controls the second largest maritime territory on the planet. The French Navy is in a wonderful opportunity to enforce against illegal fishing operations, but they don't do very much. And I've actually spoken to the admiral of the French Navy, and he agrees. But he said that their hands are tied politically.
Your organization, Sea Shepherd, suffered some criticism. For instance, your lack of tolerance towards poor population activities. For example, you made a campaign in La Réunion to protect sharks. And in fact, the local population was puzzled because it was a question of dozens of sharks, while French vessel fish thousands of tons of sharks every year, and there is no campaign there. So do you accept and understand these criticisms?
First, on the first question, we don't target anybody who doesn't act illegally. So I don't really care if people are rich or poor. If they're breaking the law, we're going to oppose them. But what we're primarily doing is going against large corporate fishing operations. I mean, we're talking about multi-million dollar corporations that are literally looting the oceans. Right now, we have one of our vessels working in partnership with the government of Gabon to stop illegal fishing in Gabonese waters. Last week, we arrested three Chinese vessels that were operating in that water illegally. Last month, we chased six illegal Chinese drift netters all the way from the Indian Ocean back to China and turned them over to the Chinese government with the evidence of illegal activity. We're working in partnership with the Mexican Navy to save the endangered vaquita. And yes, those are poor fishermen who are going after this vaquita, but they're doing it illegally. So we seized 25 long lines and about 42 illegally set gill nets, and we confiscated those. You can't use poverty as an excuse for this kind of lawbreaking. Otherwise, it would be certainly quite all right for people to sell cocaine because they're poor. It's certainly all right to rob banks because they're poor. So if you look at the ocean as a bank that contains the savings or the investment for the future of all humanity, then the poachers are no different than bank robbers. Oh, and then on the question of La Reunion, every year, the average number of people killed by sharks is 7. Which is amazing when you consider that every day about 300 million people go into the ocean. So, you know, your chances of getting killed by a shark are pretty, pretty small. In fact, it's more dangerous to play golf. If you're out golfing, your chances of being struck by lightning or being stung by a bee and dying are greater, and more people die on golf courses every year than are attacked by sharks. We need sharks. They have shaped evolution in our ocean for 450 million years. They are an apex predator, and they're essential for the ecological integrity of the ocean. Therefore, there is no excuse for killing them. The problem is the three places in the world where shark attacks are more prevalent are Queensland, Western Australia, and La Reunion Island. And what do those three places have in common? They have shark kill programs. That is, they're culling sharks and funded by the government to do that. Now, what does that do? Sharks are territorial creatures. Therefore, when you go in and you kill sharks in an area, you create a vacuum which draws more sharks into that area. And those sharks are by nature territorial, and become very aggressive as a jockey for position within that territory. Therefore, those programs in La Reunion, Queensland, and Western Australia are creating aggressive sharks. And therefore, the responsibility for the shark attacks now becomes the people who are killing the sharks. The government of France, in fact, is contributing to those shark attacks. And as for the surfers who complain about this, on our advisory board, we are fortunate to have Kelly Slater, who's the probably the foremost surfer in the world. And I think Kelly's advice to the surfers at La Reunion was quite appropriate. He said, if you're afraid of sharks, then stay out of the ocean. You don't belong there.
What is your feeling about the young generation? Do you think they care about the situation, that they understand, or on the contrary, that they gave up?
Well, there's a lot of all of that. Younger people are certainly far more aware today than 20, 30, 40 years ago. I mean, back in 1972, nobody even knew what the word ecology meant. And certainly people were blind to the real problems. So I think young people are far more aware now. Are they involved? Yes, people are distracted by everything from video games to entertainment or whatever. But I do see a level of involvement probably greater than any time in previous history. And young people actually face a very daunting challenge that other generations before them didn't have to deal with. And that challenge is the fact that this might not be a livable planet at the end of this century. I happen to believe that when you face an impossible situation and overwhelming odds, you have to find impossible solutions. And I believe those solutions can be found, again, through imagination, passion, and courage. And I'm seeing more and more of that in young people. We have 9 ships. On those ships right now, we have about 125 volunteers from 20 or 25 different nations. It all depends. And so we have thousands of people who want to participate. So there's certainly, I'm seeing the passion of people who want to get involved. And they want to get involved because when they join our vessels, they can actually get the satisfaction of seeing results for their efforts. They go down, they shut down an illegal fishing operation, or they save X number of whales, or they save X number of turtles on the beaches in, say, Costa Rica. These are real results, and therefore it gives people not only the satisfaction of doing it, but also the encouragement that they can do more. Because I believe that everybody has the ability to change things, to change the world, and that we encourage that individual initiative, that individual an individual imagination to find those solutions. You know, I find that one person championing one cause makes a difference. Because of Diane Fossey, mountain gorillas are survived in Rwanda. The work of Jane Goodall and Bruti Geltikos when she's protecting orangutans in Indonesia. These are examples of individuals who make a difference because of their passion. One man in Bermuda, David Wingate, because of him, the Bermuda storm petrel didn't go extinct. And so I encourage people all over the world when they come to me and they say, well, I'm really concerned about, you know, say, protecting jaguars in Belize. I said, well, then do that. You know, do whatever you can. Use your imagination and find ways to get involved and do things like that. So this is what we try to do, is encourage people to follow their own passions.
Soon there will be a presidential election in the U.S. For you, who could be the best candidate to defend green issues?
There isn't one. There isn't one. That's like trying to choose between, you know, cholera and smallpox, really. The problem is that the United States is not a democracy. It's an oligarchy, and they already choose the president before anybody gets to vote. I personally was backing Bernie Sanders, and I believe that he would have won if they didn't rig the election against him. And also the media refused to cover them because the media is controlled by the same people who control the corporations who decide who's going to be president. And so you're not going to really get any democratic representation in a country where the corporations have the final say. And that's pretty much true of everything. For instance, Justin Trudeau came to Paris 1 month after being elected as Prime Minister.
Justin Trudeau from Canada?
Yeah. And he was all gung-ho. He's going to really do something about climate change. I mean, he's very idealistic, and he brought in about 150 people with him, and they all sat down, and they were very, very serious, and then he went home. But he had only been Prime Minister for a month. So when he went home, the people who really control things must have sat him down and talked to him, because now he's supporting the pipeline. He's supporting the tar sands project. He's saying that the fires that they had in Alberta are not connected with climate change. So he's becoming like everybody else. It's basically because they're just puppets who are told what to do. We don't have any world leaders. We basically have puppets controlled by the corporations who actually control everything. The mining companies, the logging companies, the big fishing companies, the nuclear power companies. They're the ones that control everything. And this so-called voting is just a charade. That's why we never get anybody who actually does anything.
Have you seen the so-called the Seventh Continent or Great Pacific Garbage Patch?
I know what you're talking about. We've had a plastic campaign now for years. It's called the Vortex Project. Exactly. And what we do is we have beach cleanups around the world. We collect tons and tons of plastic from around the world and send that in for recycling. We ship it off to a central place to be recycled. Last year we brought in 72 kilometers, 70 tons of gill net from the Southern Ocean and had that turned into shoes. We're also looking for alternatives to plastic. So it's a combination of cleaning up plastic, discouraging the use of plastic, and finding alternatives to plastic. It's a big project for Sea Shepherd.
What is your feeling about Fukushima?
Well, Fukushima is something that people don't really want to talk about because...
I want to talk about it.
Yeah, I know. But in general, they don't want to talk about it because there's no solutions to it. The Japanese are trying to cover up the damage, but the damage is extreme. And it will continue to be extreme. Radioactive water is seeping into the groundwater below Tokyo. They're dumping it into the ocean. We're seeing the effects of this in fish off the coast of California and certainly in Alaska. It's a major, major tragedy that's been downplayed by the world media. But the problem with it is that how do you deal with it? You can't really clean it up. But what it does herald is the similar situation happening in other places in the world. In only just one generation, really, we've had two, almost three, major nuclear accidents. And that doesn't bode well for the future of nuclear power worldwide.
What do you think about French nuclear politics?
I'm certainly opposed to nuclear power plants. Our entire population worldwide depends on fossil fuels. You know, people think that nuclear power is clean. It isn't. It actually is very intensive use of fossil fuels because to make one ounce of uranium, you need 1,000 tons of pitch blende ore, which means that you have to mine it, you have to crush it, you have to manufacture it, you have to transport it. The amount of fossil fuels used in the nuclear industry alone almost exceeds that and used in oil and coal-fired generating plants. So it's not clean energy. That's a fantasy that it's clean energy. But... The problem really is too much energy consumption by too many people producing too many products which are essentially of no use at all. We really have to cut down on useless products. We have to find ways of stopping human population growth in a responsible manner.
What is your opinion about that?
The population will not grow beyond 12 billion. That's the limit because it'll crash before then. The planet simply cannot...
Sustain
12 billion people. It's not going to happen. And that's going to happen before the end of this century. It's going to crash. There are no easy solutions, but solutions have to be found. And I think that we also really have to concentrate on lowering our levels of consumption of materials. And instead of third world nations trying to become first world nations should be looking at lowering ourselves to a lower level of consumption.
You know peak oil?
Peak oil, yeah.
What is your opinion about it? It's a theory, it's a what?
Well, it's a finite resource. It's going to crash. And right now, we're already seeing utilization of fracking and other technologies to extract less and less of what's available. And so the problem with oil is it's a drug. And our entire civilization is dependent upon that drug.
We are junkies.
We are oil junkies, and like junkies, we'll do anything to get it. And if that means destroying the planet we live on to get it, we're going to do it. And if that means killing people in third world nations, if it means destroying our ocean, we're going to do it because we're dependent upon that drug. I mean, look at the wars that we're fighting right now over it. By 2030, we'll be probably in a major war over the Antarctic continent because that's the last untapped reserve of not just oil, but also cobalt and other coal, for instance, 200-meter seams of coal going through the Trans-Antarctic Mountains. It's untouched right now, but they'll go for it. And when they do, you're going to see major military adventures in Antarctica. So the wars of the 21st century will be wars over resources, and not just, you know, oil, but also water. We're going to have some very serious conflicts over water availability.
So in a certain way, global warming help big corporation to find oil in Antarctica.
Oh, yeah, well, it's going to make it easier. It's making it easier to exploit oil in the Arctic. It's also going to open up fisheries. It's going to open up. They see all of the benefits. That's what they actually say. Well, you know, you environmentalists, you see that the glass is half empty. We see it as half full. We see global warming as something that is going to help us economically. And that might be so for a brief period of time, but it's going to destroy us ecologically. I mean, we're seeing evidence of global warming around us all the time, or of climate change, and yet still, the major mainstream media is denying that it's a real problem. It is a real problem. It's going to be increasingly more of a problem.
There is an increasing number of people that have chosen to be vegetarian, flexi-vegetarian or vegan. Do you think that changing our eating habits helps to fight for saving the planet and its biodiversity?
I absolutely do believe that. My ships have been vegan vessels since 2000 and vegetarian vessels since 1980. Because I believe that we have to set an example, that we can't save the world by being part of the problem. 40% of all of the fish taken out of the ocean is fed to pigs and chickens and to farm-raised salmon. When you eat a hamburger, you're actually eating a fish. So we're literally eating the oceans alive. We're killing 65 billion animals every year on factory farms around the world. We're feeding more fish to, you know, for instance, to our chickens and are being eaten by albatrosses and puffins. Pigs are eating more fish than all the seals in the North Atlantic. I mean, this is just completely unnatural behavior. And I do believe that the humanity can sustain itself quite healthily on plant-based diets. They produce use less water, produce less greenhouse gases, are less of a source of pollution than animal products. So yeah, that we very much promote that, but we do it for environmental reasons. There's many ways that people promote veganism. It's ethical or for their health, but we do it for environmental reasons.
What is your opinion about the no growing?
Well, you know, no species has ever survived on this planet outside of the three basic laws of ecology. The first is the law of diversity. The strength of an ecosystem is with diversity within it. The second is the law of interdependence, that the species within that ecosystem are dependent upon each other. And the third is the law of finite resources. There's a limit to growth, a limit to carrying capacity. What we humans are doing right now is stealing the carrying capacity of other species. They have to disappear to make room for more and more of us. But what that does is diminish interdependence and diversity, which can lead to a collapse of the entire system. Civilization will cease to exist. We may go extinct. It's quite simple because we cannot survive without oxygen. We cannot survive without food. And we cannot survive with runaway climate change. So we don't survive. That's really what the final consequences are. The only way we're going to survive is to learn to live in harmony with all the other citizen species on this planet. We have to appreciate and understand the role that they play, the role that whales play, the role that fish play, the role that birds play. They all contribute to this life support system. We can't continue to act like we're the only species that matter.
That was an interview with Captain Paul Watson, founder and CEO of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. He was commander on 7 different Sea Shepherd ships since 1978. He continues to lead Sea Shepherd campaigns to protect defenseless marine wildlife around the world. He's also a prolific writer and author. His published titles include Sea Shepherd: My Fight for Whales and Seals, Cry Wolf, Ocean Warrior, and Seal Wars.
And we are back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, bringing you the news from around the world and the community all the way to 93.3 CFMU FM here at McMaster Radio. I'm very pleased today to be interviewing Eve Engler. We're going to be discussing his new book, which is called A Propaganda System: How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. So, Eve, thanks very much for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, you know, this is a momentous event because it's part of a tradition now in Hamilton and elsewhere. We are among the first to announce, advertise, promote, and have the official launches for your books, Eve. You've been at the forefront of reporting on Canadian interventionism abroad, imperialism, militarism, what mining corporations are doing, all sorts of things. And it looks to me like the recent book, this new book here, ties together some of these issues. And you discuss a whole propaganda system. And I'm just wondering, since you're using terminology like propaganda system and things like that, I'm wondering to what extent your new book borrows from or is influenced by manufacturing consent.
It is. It's certainly the section on media is influenced by manufacturing consent, but I take a much a broader look at things than just the dominant media. So I look at, the book looks at the role of different military-funded think tanks, the role of the military's fairly significant history department, and it's played a very influential role in academia and in producing histories of Canada's military endeavors. I look at different think tanks that are funded by leading Canadian capitalists, people like Peter Munk. I look at just the immense role of the military, their PR department, hundreds of people that are employed full-time to basically try to convince Canadians that the military is doing good things abroad. So it's broader than just a sort of narrow look, manufacturing consent, sort of narrow look just at the dominant media. I do look at the dominant media. I look at the role of the CBC, its close ties historically to military and external affairs officials. I look at, the thrust of the corporate media, but the book itself is the propaganda system that I'm referring to is a broader propaganda system in terms of convincing Canadians that this country is a benevolent force internationally.
Right. From what I gather, it looks like you're talking about and writing about something that's designed to promote certain ways of thinking and done in multifaceted or manifold ways. So, as you said, you have CBC, you have academia, you have research, you have all sorts of avenues for certain views to be promulgated. What broadly is being defended here? It seems to me that you're talking about, for example, the Canadian military or militarism, or sort of justifying Canada's interventionist role abroad. Is that what this whole system is designed to promote?
I would say the most simply, the book is answering the question, why do 9 in 10 Canadians believe that Canada is a force for good in the world, even though the evidence is overwhelming that Canada historically was supported the British Empire's endeavors around the world, and since World War II has generally supported U.S. Empire's endeavors around the world, and simultaneously, Canada's foreign policy has been about advancing corporate interests. So, despite an overwhelming abundance of facts demonstrating that Canadian foreign policy is not this sort of benevolent endeavor, why is it that the population, most of us, believe overwhelming that Canada is? And so, basically, there's all these different facets to it. I mean, from a simple element of Canadian mining corporations spend significant money on trying to promote what they're doing abroad, or try to deflect criticism of what they're doing abroad. And it generally works in inverse relation to how much abuse they are responsible for abroad. So a company like Barrick Gold, which is responsible for all kinds of abuses abroad, spends heavily on corporate social responsibility initiatives and PR initiatives designed to sort of portray itself positively. That's a very specific level of one corporation, but then it builds up from there, and the biggest PR department in Canada, from what I can tell, is the Canadian military. The Canadian military obviously wants to make Canadians believe that its international operations are for defending Canada or for some benevolent purpose. And it has a lot of people that spend their days figuring out different ways of trying to make that argument or to plant the seed in people's heads that the boys in the military are good people or whatever. I wouldn't say it's as simple as there's like one specific ideological objective of the Canadian foreign policy propaganda system. The broad objective is to basically portray what they're doing as good, be it at the individual level of a corporation or at the at the level of the military. And foreign affairs also has a significant PR apparatus.
So certain actors are pursuing their self-interest, and we see this being reflected via propaganda through media and things like that. Now, this is all very interesting, and it sounds like you've been really busy doing your research. Basically, from what I gather here, your book is dealing with censorship, information control, influencing on subjects ranging from Haiti to Palestine and other countries. I'm just wondering if maybe you can give us examples in a country-specific way of the way in which opinion is being formed and the public is being influenced on specific countries and issues like that.
Well, take one specific thing, like on the question of Israel. There's a number of Israeli studies departments, at least three at Canadian universities, that have been established, that were established by people who have very clear perspective on Israel studies. The most stark example is at Concordia University in Montreal, the Israeli Institute of Israeli Studies. And Azraeli was somebody who fought in the Haganah in 1947-1948 during what Palestinians refer to. That's a institute that was set up in large part to respond to pro-Palestinian activism at Concordia. That's one small example. There's literally in the book I detail, into the dozens of examples of different institutes, different departments that are funded by generally by rich people that have some political self-interest or political viewpoint that they're trying to promulgate. In the case of take Canada's role in Haiti, which is a particularly stark example of media bias. I look at some of how much coverage there have been in dominant Canadian media of different instances of important elements of the story of Canada's role in overthrowing Haiti's elected government and undermining Haitian sovereignty over the past 12 years, and you find something like the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti, where Canadian officials planned to worked with British or worked with American and French officials to plot the demise of Jean-Bertrand Aristide's government. This was all reported on in 2003 by L'Actualité, Quebec magazine. You find that it's only been mentioned in Canadian, dominant Canadian media three times since this Ottawa Initiative of Haiti took place. All three times was by little mentions by Haiti solidarity activists. There's never been a report since the time of the 2004 coup that's actually looked at in any major Canadian media that's actually looked at the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti. This is a pretty central piece of information in understanding what's going on in Haiti over the past 12 years, and an incredibly central piece of information about Canada's role specifically, and it's basically completely ignored by the dominant media. And, you know, a quick Canadian newsstand check shows this, you know, incredible bias in the dominant media. The examples are almost endless. In the book, I do more than other books I've done over the past few years. I actually bring in some personal anecdotes because I have a whole bunch of personal experience with the bias in the dominant media. And one of the ways I contrast it is with my experience writing op-eds on domestic issues. So I worked for a couple years for the Communications Energy Paperworkers Union, and I wrote about a dozen op-eds for the union, usually under the name of the president of the union. And I got them published in, you know, different papers across the country. But they were all on domestic issues. Obviously, they came with the weight, the institutional weight of the union. My personal experience writing op-eds for the Canadian corporate dailies over the past 12 years on foreign policy issues is completely horrendous. I've submitted dozens and dozens of op-eds. I believe I've had four that have ever been published. This is just, you know, one sort of small personal anecdote about how foreign policy is the realm of media and Canadian political affairs that is the most biased in favor of power, where there's the least range of debate, and there's, you know, all kinds of different examples in the book that make that point from both personal historical examples to different research that I bring to the fore.
Well, for those who are just tuning in, of course, we're speaking with Yves Engler. He's a Canadian author, journalist, activist, and his most recent book is entitled A Propaganda System, How Canada's Government, Corporations, Media, and Academia Sell War and Exploitation. Obviously, this ties together so many of the issues you've been working on from mining and what corporations are doing to responsibility to protect interventionism in Haiti, to our unbalanced position on Israel and Palestine, and all sorts of other issues. I think it's really interesting, and I'm glad you mentioned that there's this sort of discord between reporting within Canadian journalism on foreign issues as opposed to domestic issues. You can often get some level of accuracy in the corporate media on a domestic issue. If there's something about migrant workers or what a union is doing or something in Canada, you can get, if you know, you can push to get reporting that is some kind of reflection of reality, perhaps. But when you get into foreign policy, then it becomes really, really, really difficult. You mentioned the difficulty in getting op-eds in, but it seems the room for discourse really, 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 really narrows once you start talking about foreign policy, and especially Canadian foreign policy. You've had so much difficulty getting the truth out about Haiti, for example. There was more of a lockdown in Canada than there was in the United States during the coup period when they were pushing out Aristide. In 2004 to 2006, you had a lot of activity by the Canada-Haiti Action Network, thanks to yourself and a number of others, showing what Canada was doing to remove a democratically elected government. And it doesn't seem to have changed much there, because you had problems once again in 2010, 2011 during the earthquake response. And I'm wondering if you can tell us, you know, how Canadian journalists responded or didn't respond to the situation of covering what exactly Canada was doing in the aftermath of the earthquake.
Yeah, I mean, the coverage has been basically horrendous going back, you know, since the coup and, you know, before the coup. One example that was particularly stark for me that I looked into was in 2011, the Canadian press reported, got internal government documents showing that after the earthquake of 2010, where into the hundreds of thousands of people were killed, that after the earthquake, according to the official government documents through Access to Information, the concern in Ottawa was over security, and was explicitly stated concern that the post-earthquake political vacuum would lead to a popular revolt, and Aristide, who at that point was in exile in South Africa, being able to come back to the country. And in response to that, Canada sent 2,000 soldiers after the earthquake and did not send its heavy urban search and rescue teams, which are based in cities across the country, which are designed basically in the case of natural disasters or different forms of disaster to help uncover people from buildings, to provide medical help, etc. So Canada militarized its response to this devastating human catastrophe, and we have the proof of it. The Canadian press got the access to information documents showing what the motivation for sending the troops was. I did a Canadian newsstand search on this Canadian press article. How I had remembered it was that it was an example of a story that was published, but then just sort of went down the memory hole. Provides some profound context of what Canada's role, Canada's motivation in Haiti. Media reports on it, and then they just continue on as if it never appeared. But in fact, the bias was much worse than that. I found that this Canadian press article was only published in the Kamloops Daily News. So dozens and dozens of newspapers across this country that all have Canadian press wire service that often depend on Canadian press for, much of the copy in their newspapers, decided this profound piece of information was just unnewsworthy and refused to put it in their paper. That's just, one example, but it's one of many examples of very, quite frankly, impressive. The fact that news editors across the country had so deeply internalized a sense of benevolent Canada, or a sense that Canada's trying to help Haitians out, or all this kind of stuff, they internalized it so deeply that they understood that this was this was unnewsworthy. This Canadian press, incredibly revealing Canadian press report. That's one example. Just a more recent example of Haiti. I just wrote a piece about this anti-Haitian screed by CBC reporter Evan Dyer, basically providing the justification for the fact that there's an upcoming election on October 9th. Washington, about 2 months ago, this publicly announced they were not going to be supporting this election. Canada, just in this piece about 2 weeks ago, announced it was not going to be supporting this election. And basically, this is the most credible presidential election Haiti has had since 2000, and Washington and Ottawa are basically trying to undermine the poll. And so how do you justify providing material and observing and financial support to elections all these years in Haiti, when the most popular political party, Aristide Samy-Lavalas, is excluded, but now when there's a more credible election being taken place, all of a sudden Washington and Ottawa won't provide any assistance, and in fact trying to undermine the poll. And this CBC article basically is the justification for this, which is basically, we've been trying to help the Haitians out so much, now we have to give them some tough love. It's just one more example in a long line of incredibly biased reporting on Haiti. And it reflects the power imbalance, right? Global Affairs Canada has a lot of power. The majority poor in Haiti have very little power.
Yes, so as you're pointing out, when Washington's candidate is in power in Haiti, or when it looks like they're going to win, Washington takes a laissez-faire approach to the election, let things go ahead, let the government stay in. But if a popular candidate in Haiti is going to win or is in power, then Washington and the media become very disenchanted with the Haitian government or that party. It's very partisan stances that are taken by the Canadian and U.S. foreign offices, and it's reflected in the media. And we see some of manufacturing consent here, drawing from that work where there's self-censorship is practiced by journalists. They know what their editors want, or they know what's not going to get printed. And also the fact that many people in the journalistic establishment have, as you say, heavily internalized the dominant values of U.S. or Canadian imperialism, exceptionalism, and so on. So it's not needed to push the editors or harass or influence them. They already agree with the government. I guess we're sort of getting at this, what you're calling a state corporate academic NGO media network.
There's relationships between these people. So it kind of, I mean, this whole book and what you're doing and the struggle you've been pointing out to get accurate reporting out on Haiti and other issues, it points towards this problem we have of a real need for alternative media, because without you, without radio programs that discuss these issues, without alternative media on the internet, we're stuck with this nexus of people. And I think you noticed that when you were writing for the Huffington Post or trying to get an article in there, you're trying to discuss some of these issues, and you had referred to or had been able to point to interviews or sources of evidence to back up or support your claims and assertions. And Huffington Post basically said, well, we're sorry, we only publish mainstream sources. So if this isn't in, you know, CBC or the National Post, then it's not real and we're not going to publish it.
Yeah, no, that's one of the a flagrant example of bias. On two occasions, I've written about the responsibility to protect doctrine, criticized the responsibility to protect doctrine, and discussed how liberal governments, Trudeau or Chrétien and Paul Martin governments, invoked the responsibility to protect doctrine to justify intervening in Haiti and overthrowing the elected government in 2004, and of course, you know, leading to thousands of people being killed. So, certainly not protecting the population, maybe protecting capital, but certainly not protecting the population. And both occasions, Huffington Post refused to publish it. And the grounds was the one occasion where they stated explicitly, I linked to an interview that Anthony Fenton, independent researcher, academic, did with Denis Paradis, who was the person responsible for the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti, an interview he did where he referred to the responsibility to protect doctrine to justify the Canada's plotting to oust Aristide. And then also the Canadian ambassador in Port-au-Prince at the time of the coup, Kenneth Cook, he also invoked responsibility to protect doctrine to justify, in the days before the coup, anti-Aristide positions. And basically, the Huffington Post editor stated explicitly that because the sources of information weren't coming from, you know, a major media outlet or a corporate media outlet, therefore, it wasn't reliable and it was only being reported on by this, you know, one researcher, Anthony Fenton. And, you know, that's a self-confirming dynamic where if no corporate journalist is willing to look into the matter, and then corporate media outlets don't consider it reliable if it hasn't been looked into by corporate journalists, you're in a little bit of a bind in terms of discussing the matter.
Yeah, it's really convenient, isn't it? I mean, if National Post says something is true, then other news outlets can say, well, here, we're referencing the National Post. But if you guys have something out there, and if it's not picked up by one of these outlets, then it just simply doesn't exist.
And it's all throughout the foreign policy realm, right? I mean, refer again to the Ottawa Initiative in Haiti. Solidarity activists across this country, in almost every community, probably 30, 40 communities across this country, there was discussions at one point or another about the Ottawa Initiative on Haiti. Yet no corporate media picked it up and looked into it. There's, you know, Anthony Fenton also uncovered the access to information documents around that, you know, add some detail to you know, what we know, what already been reported, no reporting. But Haiti is a particularly stark example, but you find similar things with other issues. One thing like FIPAs, Foreign Investment Promotion Protection Agreements, that the Canadian government has signed with African countries over the past decade or so, a whole bunch of these. Basically, they're designed to protect Canadian mining interests in Africa and give them the ability to sue an international tribunal, secretive international tribunal, local governments for lost profit-making. In one instance, the Harper government signed one with a transition government that was, only supposed to be transitioning the way towards democratic elections after a long popular struggle. The Harper government signed one of these FIPA agreements, but they're basically in force for 2 decades. So once they're signed, future governments are locked into it, for 2 decades. And, And these FIPAs, I went and looked for any media reporting on these FIPAs, critical, nothing. There's nothing that I can find anything about critical reporting about Canada's signing FIPAs with African governments, particularly the one with regards to Burkina Faso. So, you know, it's Haiti's one example. FIPAs are another, you know, the mining industry is another example. And, you know, the basic rule of thumb is the weaker the place is, the bigger the lies. The weaker a country is, the more the Canadian government can tell, you know, just wild fibs about how they're, you know, trying to bring democracy, trying to do well, when in fact often they're doing the total opposite. And basically, the correlation between what ideas make it out there and power is a very close correlation, and I think this book, you know, strengthens the case to say, you know, to sort of, you know, prove that that's the case, certainly with Canadian foreign policy.
Yeah, it sounds like you're uncovering a situation where powerful interests across the country have a certain worldview, and somehow that gets reproduced in our dominant media institutions. It sounds interesting, and I think, yeah, you're probably going to look at some hypotheses there, look at some ideas of how things work. It should be interesting for all involved. So I just want to point out to our listeners that you're going to be in Hamilton this month, not too long from now, launching this book, and the first event is in the city proper. It's in the New Vision United Church at 24 Main Street West, and it's happening October 19th. So Wednesday, October 19th at 7 o'clock p.m. So 7 o'clock the 19th at the New Vision United Church at 24 Main Street West. And then you're also going to be on the campus here at McMaster. And that's going to be the next day, Thursday, October 20th at 12:30 at the Student Center room 230. And I think that's being done through OPERG. You can find it on their website there. So we have two chances to get your book, and everyone should. And it sounds like it should be another classic. And if this is what one Evangler could do, imagine if we had 100 citizen journalists. But maybe that's for another day. So Eve, thanks so much for being on the program with us today.
Thanks a lot for having me, and also to the great work that you do. And, you know, that the flip side to the propaganda system is the need to build up, develop, you know, media that's willing to challenge power.
I couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks very much, Eve.
Thank you.
Bye. And that, of course, was Eve Angler, and he will be in Hamilton, 2 weeks from now? So you definitely want to go and get that book and ask him questions. It's always great because he talks about the book, he explains it, so you can tell your friends what it's about, even if you didn't read it, so you can at least pretend to have read it. But no, you should you get his overview, because then you can ask him questions. And if you're uncertain about what he's trying to say or some of the examples, he remembers all the detail or a lot of it because he's been investigating a lot of these cases and issues for a while now, whether it be Haiti or Israel or mining companies or the war in Afghanistan or whatever, responsibility to protect. He has experience in all these areas, and it looks like he's really starting to tie things together, which is what we need to advance in these movements and the anti-war movement and things like that.